layao, lom 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 lady lay, he om lom layao, lom lady layao, lady 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 lady, hey a hoka hey, lady 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 lady. I see a white horse, an angel standing, goddess standing in the lotus sky, red as a dragon's eye, but light like a feather. And way across the horizon, deep in the hills, thunder is coming, echoing valley. An elven king, gentle, his master moves in robes of wind. And the poet on your breath, sweeter than peaches, bitter as grandfather time, may slip past you in a rhythm and shadow, but is received between the lines. Liddy, 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 hey, ah, ho, ka, hey. Liddy, 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 liddy. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child. Ooh. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child. Because there's no place like home.
Welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. It's that time, Thursday afternoon, and I'm Janaea, your host, and we're going to have a few other hosts streaming in and out, Teresa, Laura, and Alan. And I've got a great program today. From 2 to 3, we'll be speaking with Dr. Mark Sneller. He's the author of Greener, Cleaner Indoor Air. And we'll be learning about just how toxic our indoor environments are. And then from 3 to 4, we're going to be talking with Karen Quinn Tostada about tax-free 15th, where our tax money is going, why it's important to participate in a peaceful national strike, and are taxes legal? Then from 4 to 5, we're going to be speaking with John Bloom, and he is the author of The Genius of Money, Essays and Interviews, Reimagining the Financial World. It's going to be extremely interesting as well, looking at the sacredness of money and how we can turn around its abuse with the interest and debt that we are all struggling with. So we're going to begin with Dr. Sneller. Let me make sure he's on the line here. Dr. Sneller, are you with us?
Janaea, I'm here.
Hi.
Hey, what a pleasure. What an honor.
Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. Did you know the title?
Back to my days in San Jose. I taught at San Jose State for a while,
and
back in the day.
Oh, and you're from Arizona.
I've been here 30 years. I'm actually from the Los Angeles area. Grew up on Venice Beach and then went to Long Beach State and did a couple of years in India and then went to Oklahoma and then settled here in 1979 in Arizona.
Oh, you've been around quite a bit.
Yes.
Well,
that's why I decided to park myself in one place and make it work here.
It's a beautiful place, but you don't have the ocean.
I know. Every time I go on vacation, I have to.
You have to.
I have to have ocean somewhere.
I know. I would too. Actually, I used to live right in Sedona and then Cottonwood.
Mm-hmm.
So I know.
Oh, beautiful area of the country. Yeah. I mean,
yes.
It's all good.
Well, we're up here in Santa Cruz, so I just want to let our listeners know who you are and a little bit about you. And you started your Aero Allergy Research. It's an indoor air quality company in Tucson. And since then, you've received 2 awards in the Arizona Lung Association for work in the field of respiratory health. You were featured in Newsweek, the New York Times, Women's Day, and Prevention Magazine. You've been on ABC, NBC, and CBS, the national networks. And you've also been under contract with the Department of Justice and Department of Defense for outdoor and indoor air monitoring. Wow. And served on the State of Arizona Air Pollution Control Hearing Board. So you really are the authority on how toxic our indoor environments are. And, you know, I was shocked to find out that lead exists in household dust. And that, according to the American Lung Association, contamination from household products doesn't pose a serious health threat if it's both mild and brief. However, contamination often occurs over a long period of time and comes from a variety of sources. And then candle burning contributes to an increase in household soot. And it just goes on and on and on. Where do we begin?
I look at this in terms of two different categories, particles and gases. And, you know, once in a while the federal government can do something right. And in this case, what they did right was admit that we spend 90 to 100% of our time indoors, and that virtually all of our diseases come from indoor exposure, mental and physical, and that some people are 100%, the very young, the very old. And so our exposure to indoor pollutants is critically important. And we remember back in the day when the EPA did all this outdoor pollution studies, and they spent all the money on seeing how toxic our outdoor environment was and the smog and all of that. Now the emphasis has shifted to the indoor environment, where we do spend all our time and we catch all these horrendous types of diseases. So
we spend time
what
not
I
just
did,
in our homes.
Kind of let me ramble for a minute.
Sure.
What I did was I wrote a newspaper column for several local newspapers for 15 years. I wrote 2 to 3 columns a week. And over a period of time, I compiled those columns and updated them and then added just a whole lot of new information to give 116 chapters in this book that deals with all kinds of indoor and some outdoor air quality issues. And so then I found that really what we had was particles and gases.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go ahead and define those further.
Yes, please.
All right. Well, let's start with the gases. And by gases, what I mean is everything that we really shouldn't be exposed to. And people with chemical sensitivity will understand about fragrances and perfumes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all cringe, and rightly so.
Yeah.
Most of these do have toxic chemicals in them. They're artificially manufactured. And in fact, the EPA has placed fragrances and perfumes in the same category as heavy metals and pesticides.
Oh, my gosh.
In terms of their toxicity, yes. And
wow.
Yet we're sold these things, and we buy them. For some psychological reason, we think that, you know, they won't lie to us, or they wouldn't misrepresent themselves. And yet, you know, you can get floral-scented spray pesticide for the indoor, spring fresh pesticide in a canister, and you can put your fingernail remover, it's in a little jar, and you put your fingers in there, and it's full of acetone that's absorbed into your blood and dissolves the central nerve. And I mean, are they nuts? But that's what we buy, and that's what's commercially available. Plug-in air fresheners, everything is scented, and it causes a variety of symptoms.
I sometimes feel my eyes burning when I'm around specific scents, or I get a mild headache, and when I remove myself, the symptoms disappear. And I was wondering, and that probably is one of the reasons, probably is the reason.
Well, that definitely is, and we can all relate to mobile homes with the formaldehyde. Well, that's outgassing, and that's in the classification of what I call gases, volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. Or we can go into a carpet store, or we can go into a store where they have electronics, and all they do is sell electronics and tapes and plastic, and we can go in there and it's like a weight has fallen on us with all of this. And so headaches and eye irritation are very, very common. You don't have to be chemically sensitive to react to this stuff. It's just a natural body reaction to these foreign substances and these chemical irritants. So it can cause behavioral problems in children. It's been shown to do that. Doris Rapp, who endorses my book, and
she's a very well-known
pediatrician.
She spoke in Santa Cruz. We had some aerial spraying pest, very serious. It may still be going on. They're trying to aerial spray Santa Cruz in the county. Well, the excuse is light brown apple moth is killing the, I guess it's the apples.
Yeah, that's what it is.
But she came and spoke about the toxicity.
And she has a nice videotape out, too. It's been out for a number of years on how children act out when they are exposed to certain chemicals in school, cleaning products. And, of course, it stands to reason that that's going to happen at home. And so, you know, we wonder why our children are misbehaving. Well, let's look at our own cleaning products. Let's look at our own spray deodorants and our air fresheners and our hairsprays and all the perfume products that we have under our sink and in our medicine cabinet and all of the volatile organic compounds that are in our polishes and the petroleum distillates. And we are buried in pesticides and we're buried in fragrances and perfumes. And, you know, we need to stop and cease and desist. Because as I present four chapters, they are lemons, vinegar, baking soda, and borax as the four agents that we need to take care of 95% of our needs.
So these are the harmless
odor absorption. Pardon?
These are the harmless alternatives.
They are harmless alternatives. We can wash our clothes in them, wash our walls in them, remove odors, the whole thing. And I've got scores and dozens and scores and all kinds of lists of ways that we can use these products. And they've been around since forever, and they cost on the average of $2 a pound with $10 to $20 for what we might pay otherwise.
That's true, and we're convinced to use through advertising constantly.
Yes.
You see someone who looks like you says, this works really well. And very friendly. And
yeah, the testimonials.
Yes. Now, the products once more, lemons, borax, vinegar?
Mm-hmm.
What were they once more?
Oh, the four, oh yeah. Well, just fresh lemons, borax, baking soda, and vinegar. Vinegar serves as your disinfectant for countertops. It can also be used, a little vinegar on a rag thrown in the dryer will substitute for your anti-static whatchamacallits and prevent all that heavy fragrance product from going into the clothing. And we wash our sheets and pillowcases with fragrance detergent and put it in a dryer with some kind of fragrance, and then we put our faces next to it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
So anyway, so then we had, what did I say? So we have the baking soda, which absorbs odors of all kinds. We use it in a refrigerator. We can use it around the house for all kinds of odors. And we don't need to use fragrances, which are masking agents. We all know about going into motels and hotels. I just wrote a piece for a green magazine that goes out to lodgings about the use of fragrances in those rooms and to cease and desist.
And what did you say? What was the...
Well, that was basically it. You know, that one of the problems with lodgings and that people find so irritating, literally and figuratively, is going in and with all the heavy scented products, and they need to cut those back and go to something simpler. It would be, you know, these people operate on a margin, a very thin margin, too, and if they could find a way to cut back on their product usage, that would be tremendously economical and sure help all of us who want to be have a little greener indoor environment. So that's kind of the general run-through on the gases part, but then you got the whole part of it, too. And those include pollen and mold. Plant parts, which are particles that are given off by plants at a time of the year different from when they give off pollen, but they all have the same antigen. And then you have carbon exhaust from vehicles, which is allergenic unto itself.
Yeah.
It's in every home, every air measurement that I do, and I've done thousands, tens of thousands of measurements, and it's always there, everywhere. And so it can, depending on where you live, you could have more or less of this automotive carbon in your home, and that's a measure of automotive pollution that's coming into your home. So there are ways to avoid all of this, not all of it, but to minimize your exposure to it.
And what do you recommend?
As far as the fragrances, I would say cease and desist, or at least, you know, if you're not going to totally abstain, just think about what you're doing and look at the product label. It's really hard to avoid fragrance because there's so many things that are fragrance.
Mm-hmm.
Toilet paper and toilet tissue and Kleenex, and, you know, a lot of these are fragrance.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of it is fragrance-free, too. And, you know, some of the manufacturers are getting the hint. There are some soaps out there that are fragrance-free. There are art supplies that don't give off VOCs. You know, I remember the markers, that magic
VOCs.
Markers, how they used to stink, and they were addictive. And they're a glue, and they had glue-like properties in terms of the VOCs that were released.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to, the manufacturers went to water-based markers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is this transition, but nonetheless, the other end is gearing up, too.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more things. You know, I was thinking about talking about this today for the show, and as a thought, it occurred to me that some things are very difficult to avoid. It's like looking for a product, a canned product, that does not have any onion in the label, or tomato in it, some additive. You know, I can't have anything with onions in it because it keeps me up all night.
Oh.
And so I try, but once in a while, you know, so I said, what can be wrong with ketchup and French fries? And then I finish off the French fries, and I'm reading the ketchup bottle, and it says it has onion powder added to the ketchup along with sugar, which is another thing. It's in everything, and they're making me crazy with all these things that are added, and it's hard to find even a salad dressing without sugar. So the point is that fragrances are in everything as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really have to be very careful and, you know, to just not even buy those things and just go to something that's very, very simple and back off. Take out everything that's underneath the sink. Take out everything that's in the medicine cabinet and line it up and look at it and scratch your head and say, holy smokes, did I spend a lot of money on that and I don't even use it or I don't even need it.
Let it go.
And I didn't even know it was there.
It's a cumulative effect will kill you at some point. But what startled me was that two facts. Lead exists in household dust, and then how candle burning has contributed to an increase in household soot. I burn candles.
Yeah, I'm asked about candles a lot, which is interesting because that was sort of a little side article. Based on my experience with it, and we'll address that one first, and then you can remind
sure.
me because I tend to go lead. Off. But yeah, okay. Well, remind me after I forget. But,
sure.
But the candle deal. From what I'm told and what I understand, beeswax is a better medium than wax, than normal candle wax.
That's good to know.
The wicks. If you buy candles that are made in China, the wicks are going to have lead in them. Just like a lot of other products that come from China have lead. I'm going to go off here just for a second, but there's one national chain of hardware stores that must sell, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of rubber hoses they sell that are made in China, but there's a tag on those hoses that says, made in China, avoid handling the nozzle because it has lead. Wear gloves when using this hose and wash your hands thoroughly afterwards. Yeah.
That isn't
right.
a warning. So, I don't know what
So it is. Anyway, I don't know where... So I'm saying, talking about lead and China, but let's get back to the issue of candles. So the real problem with candles comes with overuse of candles in a closed home where there's no air circulation, or the use of fragranced candles. And overuse, I don't mind a little smell, odor, you know, that's fine. I mean, I don't odor fragrance, that's good. But I don't particularly enjoy a very heavily fragranced home where candle burning is going on all the time, and there are a lot of people who are into that. And it's usually the things that we are into that gives us our problems. People who are allergic to cheese love cheese, and their refrigerators are filled with cheese or chocolate, and they'll eat a pound or two. Oh, I don't know how I could possibly be allergic to cheese or chocolate, because I've been eating it all my life.
And a food allergy.
Yeah, but they have these terrible allergies, and they're allergic to the kind, or they're reactive to the kinds of things to which they're overexposed.
Mm.
And so the idea then is to avoid overexposure. All right, so the candle, what happens is the soot builds up, and so the walls become gray, and you're adding the particles, and these particles are submicron. They're extremely, extremely small. And they're adding fragrance to the air, and they're adding particles to our respiratory tract.
Mm-hmm.
And we're inhaling that which is not meant to be inhaled. And But it's an easy fix. Buy unscented candles and maybe get a candle that's, maybe it's a beeswax or something like that. Or at least have a little bit of cross ventilation in your home when you're burning candles. And then as far as the lead...
And avoid the scented candles.
Pardon?
And avoid the scented candles.
Right. Yeah, just buy unscented candles. Avoid that. If you want
they
candles,
can be overwhelming.
That's fine, you know. The candles are fine, but avoid the scents.
I walk into a home... And the scent is just overwhelming. It feels like an assault on my sensibility.
And their children may have asthma as well. And their children, and they can't understand why their children are having asthma attacks at home. And it's because of all of this kind of thing that you and I detect when we come from a clean environment into that. That to them, it's a house. Oh, boy, I'm back home, and it smells like my house. But their child is reacting, or Uncle Joe is reacting when he comes into the house and has an asthma attack.
Mm-hmm.
The pets and children are affected, and adults are affected by that. Now, as far as the lead, that goes into the particle category.
Yes.
And most of the dust that comes into the home, most of the contaminants, including pollen, is trapped in. And so pesticides, most homes that have pesticides, say a dozen pesticides. And most of those have never been used in that home. They're tracked from the neighbor's yard or from somebody's fertilizer, or they're blown on from spraying outdoor crops. For a lot of different ways, they get into the dust of the home. And some of them are very long-lived. Some of them can last 20 years.
Oh.
And so they accumulate in a home. They're on the wallpaper. They're in the dust. And as the dust circulates through the air handling system or throughout the rooms, just the natural air currents, and then they just stay. And they build up and build up. And so to me, opening the home to fresh air is once in a while, you got to do it. Just clean it out and flush it out. You know, it's like,
Our
car, like our bodies, just once in a while, give it a flush.
You know, I usually keep the windows open in my home, and yet you advise that when you're sleeping to keep the windows open, but caution against doing this. And why?
We're all in different circumstances. We're all around, we live in different places around the country and around the world. And what's good for one person isn't necessarily good for the other. Fragrances, that's kind of universal. Back it off. Maintain a very clean and simple home. Have doormats at the front. If you can, take off your shoes at the door so you don't track in and then have that much dust in the home.
Sure.
Maintain a good quality air filtration system or a good quality air filter like that. Now, as the window is concerned, it depends on if it's pollen season. All right, use your common sense. And if you have, pollen is present in your neck of the state and neck of the woods, opening the window at night is not advised. And especially if you're in a low-lying area where gravity and air pressure and cool air in the morning forces that pollen down and compresses it and makes it more concentrated and comes in that window. Whereas there are seasons of the year where it is enjoyable to open up the window and sleep like that, but other times, if you do, you're going to get hammered with pollen or mold allergens that will enter the home. And so, you want to kind of be aware. Watch what the weatherman's saying. So a lot of what I'm trying to do is be comprehensive and basic and educational in my writings.
Yeah, you are. I think your book is invaluable, and it's packed with what we need to know and very practical and easily accessible by chapters.
Yeah, I tried to make it very reader-friendly with large type and off-white paper, and you know, and there are a couple of very good websites which I refer to a number of times as well. One of them is the CIIN, Chemical Injury Information Network.
I'm sorry, what was that once more?
CIIN. You can just dial that
C-I-I-N.
In.
CIIN.
Chemical Injury Information Network. But I think you'll just get there with CIIN. And that's an organization that produces a newsletter, Our Toxic Times. I advertise in that newsletter. And they deal with chemical sensitivity just a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those people who are... believe that they have a sensitivity to electromagnetic waves and like that. And there's another one, NCEHS, National Center for Environmental Health Strategies, and they've been around for a long time. They're based in New Jersey, and they deal also with these kinds of these issues.
Great.
And there are other agencies and organizations too on a national level that. I really don't mind promoting.
And they're kept up to date, probably, too.
Yes, very much so. Right,
updated.
What's going on in Congress and
yes.
EPA this and FDA that.
Now, another thing I want to ask you, what do you recommend in terms of vacuum cleaners and air filters, and how can they contribute to cleaning up our indoor air? Or do they?
Yeah, good. That's a trick question. Yeah, you hit your smart lady.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to start with?
Vacuum cleaners.
Okay. Consumer Report says that you should be able to get a pretty decent unit for in the $200 to $300 range, maybe even a little bit less than that. I'm not sure what their latest finding is, but they're pushing canisters as probably being a little bit better than upright because of less leakage. And it's that dust leakage that's an issue in most vacuum cleaners.
Leakage.
And anybody who's operated a vacuum cleaner can look at the amount of dust when you're finished. So they have leakage. Canisters, of course, have the versatility of the wands that can go underneath things and get the cushions, you know, in the corners and like that. That's really important.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're gonna try to get a broad wand or a brush type. What do you call the bottom hose? You know, that's a little wider if possible. So then. Vacuum slowly and go crosswise. Don't be in a hurry because you're just going to create airborne dust.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got instruments that will show that airborne dust can go up 100-fold after you're through vacuuming. So that needs to be done carefully and cautiously. On the other hand, you can check out your own vacuum cleaner as far as make and model and go down to somebody who sells that and see if they make upgraded bags, because the last number of years most units responsible vacuum cleaner makers do make good quality bags, better quality I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kinds of things that you want. It's like buying an upgraded filter for your central, you know, your central system.
Sure.
For the home. So that's kind of the vacuum cleaner summary.
And sometimes they just recycle the odor that is already in a carpet.
Yes, it's interesting.
There's if something just has always, I don't know what causes the odor sometimes, but
it just absorbed odors from the home.
Yes, it seems to stir it
and
up and intensify.
Mm-hmm, that's true, and especially if there's any moisture around.
Oh.
Because our sense of smell requires moisture in order to be activated.
Mm.
And if there is any, and we, you know, a wet carpet, everybody knows that can be pretty nasty. So
yes.
The idea there is to dry it out as quickly as possible once it's shampooed. And a good deep cleaning wouldn't hurt once in a while. But make sure that you're rigged for a fast dry on those carpets as well.
And what do you recommend cleaning them with? Would it be lemons and vinegar?
I would say, well, first of all, if you're going to have I wouldn't do my own carpets. I wouldn't go down to the local supermarket and rent a carpet cleaner for whatever they charge, $20 for the day.
Yes.
And their soap and detergent, which is fragranced, or even if you got non-fragrance, it doesn't get down deep enough. And really, if you're going to do any carpet cleaning, I'd go commercial. But there are commercial companies that just will use injected carbon dioxide, injected water, and just make sure that there's no, they don't add any of this. They'll try to sell you this and that. And the other thing, I would avoid it and just go with a good deep steam clean. And I think you'll be a lot happier that way. It's also less expensive. So check with them, and then, you know, make sure that they haven't used the same machine, you know, the job before did fragrance, but now they're running their product through a clean hose line. You know, that's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it had fragrances in it before, it's going to have it now. So just kind of ask some basic questions.
And what can you say about air filters? That's a debate I'm having with a friend of mine. Pro or con?
All right, here's the lowdown on that deal.
Okay.
here's the lowdown. The national scandal.
Oh.
You know, it's probably, you know, maybe a $1 billion industry.
Wow.
Air purifiers and air cleaners. All right. Portables and what have you. Clinically, in 100 years of selling hundreds of different types and models, it has never been proven to decrease a person's clinical symptoms.
Really?
And there are reasons for that. Part of that reason is that scientifically, it is almost impossible to set up an experiment where you can take 10 control subjects that don't have a particular issue versus 10 that do and conduct tests such that you can actually show that there's a significant difference. It's been tried, and it fails again and again and again. Now, that being said, it stands to reason empirically, if we can use that word, that if you reduce the particle load in a room, then you are going to reduce your exposure to allergens and threats to your body and reduce your clinical symptoms, whatever they may be. That sounds reasonable to me. So from the scientific standpoint, it's just really our failure as scientists to show it. But that makes more sense to me than you know, the moon is made of green cheese. and so my effort would be to get a quality machine in my bedroom. I want to assign one room in my house as a clean room. Let's call it the master bedroom or Johnny's room or some place that I can escape to.
Where you
so
are.
That no matter what's going on. You know, it's real
peaceful
simple.
As well.
And take my bedspread, accumulates a lot of dust, take that outside once in a while and beat the heck out of that once in a week because that has 10 to 100 times the amount of dust as the air does.
Mm-hmm.
And getting into bed at night and fluffing that up and kind of envisioning a cloud of dust going up doesn't excite me very much.
No.
So I want to get that out of the house and beat that. And the same thing with the pillows once in a while. Get them out.
Yeah.
All right. And so keep that bedroom as a clean room. Get your air purifier in there and close the door.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to try to filter the air of the entire home with that one small unit, and it's not going to work.
Right.
So you want something with three kinds of filters. You want it's got a pre-filter, and it's going to have a HEPA filter, and then it's going to have carbon filtration to get the odors out.
Can you go over those once more, please? The pre-filter, carbon
pre-filter, it kind of looks like a sponge on the outside.
Oh, yes.
And then the inside of that is a HEPA, H-E-P-A, and that's the best filter that's made. And it was originally made for atomic submarines and for surgical rooms, and now it's used commercially. And so it takes out the smallest bacteria, and it filters will not take out odors, but carbon will, charcoal will. You have to change that, and that'll be the inner filter inside. And that's the last thing. You do not want to get carbon on the outside. It loads up real fast. If you do that, then it's no good. So that, and then you want to check on your guarantee for the unit, make sure it's returnable, make sure it's not too loud for you, and then you can just keep that thing on all the time. And there are a number of very excellent companies that have been doing these sort of things for years.
Gosh.
And then for the central, I'd go, first of all, use a pleated filter. I've seen 200,000, $250,000 homes. They'd have a central filter for their heating, central air supply. You pull it out, you can look out at it, and you can, the mesh is so big you can see through it. I mean, what's that all about? Those filters get better as they get loaded up with dirt because the pore size gets smaller.
Oh.
I mean, you want something.
Oh, sure.
What you want is a pleated filter. Looks like an accordion. And a fairly thick one, if you can. 3M
thick
makes
and
a good
pleated.
Product.
Okay.
And
okay.
So, yeah. And so those are available. Three good quality. And you don't want to get too big a filter. You know, you kind of got to check with your hardware people and stuff, because you get some super-duper filter and the air can't pass through it, you're going to mess up your air handling system. But basically, there are some good quality filters that will fit your size, you know, 1 inch by 24 by, you know, by whatever width and length it is. So, that used in conjunction with wiping off your shoes at the door or taking them off, in conjunction with air filtration, and in conjunction with, you know, in the bedroom, and then in conjunction with cutting back on the fragrances, and man, you're set. Because what's going to happen is that your system isn't going to overload. You know, the cup can only get so full. And you start adding fragrance, and you start getting a dose of pollen, and you start getting a heavy dose of dust.
Again,
and we add, and then we get a storm front come in, and that's another issue.
What can you
and
say?
And so that adds to it all.
And what about a storm? There's so many questions I want to ask you, but now I'm curious about a storm front coming in.
Okay.
What can you say about that?
Well, that brings out the section on how weather affects our health. And there are many, many ways. But what the end of the story is that it's one more ingredient into the stew. And it's a witch's brew, if you will.
It will
cause symptoms. And everybody can relate to what I'm going to say here in just a second. But even on a minor level, it will make that cup run over. And so you're going to have allergy. It's going to trigger asthma. And this thing's been studied for thousands of years. Thousands. This study goes back thousands of years. But in areas of Europe, they give it as part of the weather report. And as a matter of fact, at one point in time, I wrote television programming for a news station and fit in how the weather affected your health, and they put that into their weather report. So now, with that introduction, the grossest example, or the largest example, you take your pick, is there's going to be a large pressure drop. And the weatherman says the barometric pressure is going to drop. We have a big Pacific storm coming in. All right? And so within 48 hours, some people are going to start to react. The most common symptom is headaches. And women are three times as sensitive as men, and there are three times as many women who are weather sensitive as men. So they're really good barometers. And so the headache will begin. My knees might start to hurt, or my old war wounds, you know, I don't have any of those, but, you know, weekend warrior type wounds. Accumulated years of assault on my body, and that scar tissue is going to start to ache. And so that's going to go on through that storm front while that barometric pressure drops, and then it's going to kind of ease off after the storm goes, and then a couple days after that, I'm going to be hunky-dory. All right, so that's the most common type of ache. And when the barometric pressure drops, then there's an influx of tissue fluid into the scar tissue areas and the old worn-out joints.
That's why.
And then that pressure presses on nerve endings and causes pain.
Oh, very interesting. I wondered what caused that, because I, too, in damp weather, begin to ache my knees or my lower back. But another thing I want to talk about, you mentioned asthma. Time goes by so fast. And when you're stuck in an office and there is a high, you wrote about a high incidence of asthma in offices, and it triggers respiratory conditions.
Yes.
And what are your concerns about that? Most of us are stuck in the summertime.
The big concerns in offices is lack of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And
air conditioning.
Air conditioning. There's not enough fresh air and makeup coming in, or you got some folks who just feel like they need to put on just lots and lots of perfume. And that's an asthma trigger. And there are any kind of strong odor is an asthma trigger.
Mm.
And since 85% of asthma is allergic asthma, then you know, if there's any allergens around that are tracked in, then or not removed via the cleaning crew, then asthma can come to the fore. And so it can present itself among people who are sensitive. The cleaning crew in offices is usually the part of the problem, big part of the problem.
That was
my
hunch.
And it's hard to find a good... Huh?
That was my hunch, too. They come in with all their scented products from other offices as well.
Or quick vacuums. I've seen dust particles in an old office, not dust, but carpet fibers that... 3,000 to 5,000 per cubic meter of air, and that's huge. Usually, you know, I'll see maybe 50 or 100, and but sometimes 3,000 to 5,000, and that's monstrous. That's you know, that's outrageous, and you know, that's just irritants and things that we're going to inhale. And part of it is because it might be because the carpet is old, but a lot of it has to do with cleaning crew, too, and not vacuuming and dusting properly, not even worrying about what's up above eye level. So, you know, for those who are going to get a job in a new office, awareness helps. You know, how close are you to the copy machine? You know, that's a big place with a lot of ozone being generated. And copy rooms that might once have been made for one or two machines now have 5 or 6 machines in the same space and crowded with a half a dozen people at once. So, you know, so there's a lot to deal with in terms of offices, from fragrances to particles, and being aware. You might want to kind of take a walk around, and if you have your choice of where you want to be stationed, or your office or your desk, if you have that choice, you might want to choose one over another, because maybe the gal down the way just decides she's going to slop the hogs with lots of pour the whole bottle on her head. I don't know. Or some guy might go heavy with the aftershave. I mean, we got to have a balance. I don't want to pick on women, but you know, so maybe some guy's heavy with the
Or deodorants sometimes, too. Deodorants can be stifling.
Yeah, they do make unscented deodorants, though, too.
They do, yes. But some people
anyway,
don't
so offices are very interesting. And if there are leaks, then we got the whole mold issue, too.
Yes, that can be a real problem. And I'm concerned, too, about schools in air quality. You had written about some very alarming statistics that indicate that the air quality is worse in schools. And then I wonder about, what is it, ADHD, if some of the toxins are triggering that.
Yeah, I agree.
You do. What can you say about it?
I think a lot of it goes back to cleaning crews. And a lot of it is unavoidable, too. For example, most homes that have cat antigen never had a cat.
Really?
Same thing with schools. If you, cat antigen is everywhere. It's tracked in. So if little Johnny has a cat or two cats at home, he brings it into the classroom, and now everybody's exposed to cat antigen. Well, we can't do anything about that, you know, but that's just part of it. It can't be vacuumed up. It's pretty much on everything and around everything. But tracking does play a big role, and cleaning off shoes outside the door on you know, nice bristly mats is going to go a long way to reducing exposure of children. If we're looking at you know, younger children,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you start getting into junior high and high school, now we're dealing with shops, and that's mm-hmm. a whole different deal too. Auto shops and auto body shops and all mm-hmm. of the VOCs that are given off there. And that transitions into home hobbies. I mean, it's all interconnected.
Sure. Oh. But what about ADHD?
I think Doris Rapp does address that. And I would certainly consider her more of an expert in that arena than I am. But I would put behavioral disorders and learning mm-hmm. disorders. I think a lot of them are, and a good solid percentage is not, you know, you don't need to give Johnny his dose of, you know, pharmacologically related drugs mm-hmm. as prescribed by his doctor. You just need to keep him away from Mrs. Jones, who insists on wearing all this perfume all
sure.
the time.
You have to
or, you know, that kind of a deal.
Source.
Or take a look at the cleaning products that are used. And you know why? What do they use? Many schools, if not most schools, do use EPA-approved products, but a lot of them still don't. Sometimes, you know, you got to take a look at the janitor's closet and see what's all stacked up there. What kind of stash that man has?
Mm-hmm. And that's
so. Then you have the diesel exhaust from idling buses that comes into the air.
Oh yeah, that's
air return. You have lawns being mowed and particles being generated from that, and they're just as allergenic as the pollen is, grass pollen. So schools are pretty, and then you have the crowded situations, you know, where you have 20 people in a small place.
Yes.
I mean, it just goes hand in hand, but there are a lot yeah. of very simple things that we can do to reduce the exposure of children, whatever age, or adults, you know, I mean, adults go
what
to school
too. What do you recommend?
Pardon?
What do you recommend other than wearing a face mask?
When
you're forced to be in an office and attending school and being with others, asking
well, I mean,
not
I,
to
I
wear.
Think it comes back to us maintaining the best health that we can in general.
Sure.
And maintaining ourselves in a, you know, nutritionally fit mm-hmm. situation to make us more resistant to these exposures.
And boosting our immunity.
Exactly. And I mean, holidays are, you know, it's pretty hard to escape. What's going on during the holiday season?
Oh, the sugar.
The dietary, the fruit and nut rolls, and you know they're highly allergenic. Or, you know, be aware of what you're going to give somebody.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like them, give them a fruit and nut roll.
Watch them. Their face turn red like MSG.
Yeah, we got
oh,
it. It's got a lot of MSG in it too.
Oh.
Yeah,
goodness.
So your lips will swell and you'll have a headache, but it should taste good.
I don't think so. What goes
yeah.
around comes around sometimes.
I know.
Be very careful.
I know.
The subtleties of that vindictive streak. Oh. And you, I'm curious about television being an asthma trigger.
Oh, my little
FA. What can you say about that?
Well, it was just something that,
I'm
you know, when I put all of this advocate. Together, and part of my reading had to do with an article, actually it was a book written back in the 70s by a man named Jerry Mander, and he was talking about the evils of television.
Oh, I love that book. One of my favorites.
Yes, and he did such a good
I'd
job,
like
and
to
I
get
said,
him
you know.
On. He did. The four, I forget what it was about television, the actual title, but...
Well, what I did is I loved it, and it was so ingrained, it was so perfect, and what I did is expanded on it and showed the amount of hours that we watch television over a day and a year and a lifetime, and I showed statistically how we could learn 5 new subjects a year for the rest of our lives if we didn't watch television, anything from linguistics to engineering to art to bird watching and sciences, and that's for each person. And then I looked at it from the stress level, and that's one of the things that he talked about, but I took it a step further, because all of the things that I talked about in greener, cleaner, indoor air really had to do with stress. And disease is stress. I mean, any disease is a stress on the body.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we stress the body enough in a certain direction, it's going to go wrong on us.
Yeah.
And so I looked at television as a stress that adds on one more. But see, stress is the trigger. So you have all of these different factors that are in your exposure to pollen and your exposure to mold and the fragrances. And it doesn't matter if it was, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning and you're sitting there at home at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. You've been hit. You've been hit for the day. And that cup is up there. That cup is getting full. And then you're going to sit down and you're going to watch 200 people get shot. And you're going to watch 200 commercials with people yelling at you and screaming at you and pointing their finger at you, that people you would never let into your home to do that, but now you're letting them into your home, and you're trying to relax, but it's not relaxing, because when you go to bed, all you do is you see these images, and it's just stress upon stress upon stress. And so there, to me, makes it an asthma trigger.
I see. I was wondering. Yeah, just walking home through your neighborhood, who knows what you're accumulating. Mm-hmm. And then you can smell. I can often smell detergent from people's laundry.
Yeah.
Or just going by
the
laundromat. That's
just
overwhelming.
You know,
disgusting.
Let your own home, you know, be your safe place.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least you have one place that you can control. And that's your home, or your own sanctity, or your office, or your bedroom, or some area in your domicile. And
the only thing we do have in our homes, we have cell phones and computers. And what can you say about electromagnetic fields?
I have never been a big fan of that being a causative factor in illness. I think, you know, every once in a while we hear about a new cell phone study and that it's going to cause tendency to
tumors
cause cancer or this and that. You know, I'm not a big fan of that. I know some people say that they're sensitive to it and everything, and okay, maybe they are. That I've read. Pardon?
It could be in the future, though, that they'll be high.
Oh, we might be measuring the wrong thing.
That's
we might be measuring the wrong thing right now.
And what studies have you looked into on EMFs?
I've read a number of papers that talk about measuring electricity below the skin as electromagnetic waves are assaulting our body from different sources, you know, in the home. And the waves only go, don't even penetrate the skin or get down into the any area where they can really affect any significant sensory perception of our body, if you will. I read studies about people who live under these very, very high voltage power towers. And in one study, there was an incidence of leukemia and among the people who lived under these things. So it was a big national scandal until further investigation found that they were all friends, and they had all decided they were going to live out in that area, and they had all worked for the railroad and worked in the hazardous chemical loading docks of the railroad.
Interesting.
But they all moved under this one thing. If they'd have moved on the seashore, then somebody would have said, well, that's the ocean that's doing it.
I don't know.
So,
I don't think
I haven't run into anything really, really solid that convinces me that it's an issue, which isn't to say that I can't be wrong or that there are people out there who are listening to us right now who are reactive. And if they are, I'd love to hear from them.
I don't believe the jury's in yet, but I have a funny feeling that it is messing with our systems internally, and I don't know exactly what, because I haven't done any research on it yet. But I know that I often feel more tired if I'm on my cell phone for a long period of time or working on the computer. And if I'm, and sometimes I'm just so used to that feeling. And then when I get away for days, if I'm out camping in the fresh air, I don't have any of those symptoms. And as soon as I pick up my cell phone, I notice something. And then someone explained to me that it's like frying your brain. And they sent me an email and a picture of brain being fried without any real backup, but nonetheless, where did that come from? And I'll get in touch with them and find out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with
where
you.
That comes from.
I think now the computer part, I'm not sure about that because the studies that I've read and some really serious stuff shows that once the impulses decrease with the square of the distance away, and by about 3 or 4 inches away, there ain't nothing. Mm. Coming off of that machine that you can measure, or 2 inches away or something. If you're right up to it, yeah. But once you're at working distance, there's nothing that reaches you.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Maybe your screen's too bright, and you get eye fatigue. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'd like to find out. But it's an interesting area to me that I might need to spend more time on and see if I can come to some conclusion.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be asking you about it more and more. And we're going to have to go pretty soon. We have about 5 more minutes, but I want to ask you more about mold.
Mm-hmm.
And how hazardous do you think it is? And what about the lawsuits involving mold?
Mm-hmm. Well, most of it is bogus. The whole deadly toxic black mold thing is a made-for-television scam. In my opinion, there's no major medical association that believes that the toxins from inhaling mold spores can cause any harm to the body. Not the American Medical Association, American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, pediatric societies. The U.S. Congress. I mean, nobody believes it. Nobody subscribes to that. Lung associations. Nobody supports that at all. So that being said. Now, mold is an allergen. You have a couple of ways to go with mold. One is the odor, which may cause more problems than inhaling the spores. And lawsuits is just a fashion. Lead and asbestos and hemp and fever virus and on and on. I mean, it's a fad. And the whole lawsuit business about mold is unfounded in most cases. In most cases, and I've served as an expert witness. And I can tell you that it's in many, if not most cases, it's bogus.
I haven't been impacted by it, but I know people that swear they have been, and they go into a room and they have horrible reactions to it.
Well, that's fine. But we're talking about lawsuits, and I'm not saying that people aren't reacting to it. I mean, I got my PhD, my master's and PhD, specializing in medical mycology, and I've created toxins in the laboratory. I've injected them into experimental animals, unfortunately, at one point.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. Well, we all kind of regret certain things in our lives. But so I know a little bit about that subject.
Mm-hmm.
And people will react to the odor of mold just as VOCs, as they will, because they're kind of petrochemicals that are being produced by mold that gives them that smell.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the spore issue, which is an allergy type of an issue. And people can react to one or both of those. But your baseline spore count in Arizona, in say southern Arizona, your baseline spore count is maybe 200 spores per cubic meter of air.
Mm-hmm.
You go into say Florida or the southwest, southeast, and you're looking at 30,000 to 40,000. Not 30 to 50 or 100, but you're looking at 30 to 40,000, 24/7, 365. And yet we have more lawsuits in Arizona than they have in Florida per capita.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So but mold is a real issue, and it doesn't mean that you're not sensitive to it. And you need to fix the problem. You need to fix if you have a house leak and you got a moldy wall and mold's coming through and everything, you got to fix it.
Because
you got pets that react to it too, and children are a lot more sensitive than adults.
Yeah. But before we go, what advice do you want to give to our listeners about keeping a cleaner, greener home? And then I want your website so people can go online and look up more of what you have to offer.
Well, I think just really keep it simple and back off the the purchases, read the labels where it says fragrances, try to avoid those labels, or use the product sparingly, and go to green cleaning products. Remember, you have to reduce the VOC level in the home somehow, and you have to find a way to reduce the particles. It doesn't take money to do either of those. So that's the neat part about the whole thing.
Yeah. And what is your website? I
have that. GreenerCleanerIndoorAir.com.
GreenerCleanerIndoorAir.com. And that's also the name of your book. And don't you write for a magazine?
Pardon?
Don't you write for a magazine on a regular basis?
Not at present time. Not at present time. I do submit blogs to Boomer Living, but I don't really have a regular magazine that I write for anymore. I've kind of backed that off and concentrated on some other issues, like running my company, which is an indoor air quality company.
And what is the name? That's Aeroallergy Research.
Aeroallergen, G-E-N. Yeah.
Oh.
Aeroallergen Research.
Allergy. And then it was boomerliving.com.
Yes.
And that's online.
Yes.
And you can, it's boomerliving.com. They can go online and look at what other articles you've written as well.
Correct.
And then greenercleanerindoorair.com.
And that's available through all of the normal, you know, internet sites, Amazon and Wheatmark and Borders.com and all the usual types of sites. Uh-huh.
And then you have Wheatmark.com. That's right.
Wheatmark. They published the book.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sneller. And your book is chock full with information. It's practical. It's easy to understand. And scientific. It's backed up.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Renee. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to be on your program.
For me, too. It's been quite informative. And I have to finish your book. I've had
three
to read
this week. I don't know if I'd read it straight through.
I've sort of been taking it by chapter by what is of interest to me at
the
moment.
Exactly. That's the way to go about it.
And, or to people that I know that are complaining of various symptoms. I'm now saying, well, what do you have in your home?
Right. There.
Clean it up.
You're knowledgeable now.
Cleaner.
You got educated.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
You're
where else can you go to find that information? It's all in your little book. It's handy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right. Well, that was Dr. Sneller, author of Greener, Cleaner Indoor Air, and we're going to be speaking with Tax-Free 15th, Karen Tostada Quinn. She'll be on in about 5 minutes, and right now I'm going to play some Lal for you, the attorneys from Palestine that are singing for freedom. Where's Lal? Oh, it should be coming on. Here we go.
Thank you. of the sea.
Quinn on the phone, and she is the creator of the website taxfree15th.com. About 2 weeks ago, I picked up the connection and read an article, Tax-Free 15th, A Call for Peaceful National Strike, April 15th, that's today, beginning today, through the 19th. So I got in touch with Karen, and she graciously offered to come in, and we're going to be talking about, is it legal for the government to tax us? And where does our tax money go? So much of it is going into the war and much more. Let's make sure she's on here. Karen. Karen, are you with us?
I am. Now
Hi.
I can hear you.
Great. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
It's my pleasure to be here. I love Santa Cruz. It's a beautiful area.
Where are you from?
Well, originally from Southern California, and actually I believe that my home's on Catalina.
Oh, so you know very well.
Yeah.
State.
Santa Cruz was always a favorite place of mine to go.
It's beautiful. We're fortunate. We have the ocean on one side and the mountains on the others. Gorgeous.
It is. It was always just a real favorite spot. So you are fortunate.
But I really want to thank you for being an inspiration to so many people. You basically are, I guess you didn't start the call for a peaceful national strike, but you certainly have been an impetus, working day and night to keep this going.
Well, I did start the call for the national strike.
You did.
It's just that the idea of a strike isn't new, but I just felt that the time had come for Americans to realize the predicament we were in and to grow a backbone.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. There's a lot of fear going around right now, fear about speaking out. And can you say a little bit about the strike, what's involved, not going to work, not buying anything, and don't comply?
Sure, because in my opinion, it is the easiest way to participate in letting the government know that we're not responsible for speculative banking debt. We didn't give them permission to spend our money like this. We got government gone wild, partying on our dollar, top shelf partying on our dollar, and stealing right out from under us while they have billion-dollar profit, $52 billion in profit for the privately owned Federal Reserve, not to mention all the multimillion-dollar bonuses for the CEOs of Goldman Sachs and AIG, you know, and it's just really ridiculous. So
and we're paying for
my
it.
Idea, and those who felt that it resonated with them as well, is to emulate the works of Gandhi and other great people, and Martin Luther King, just to be peaceful and to withdraw support, because as long as we keep going about our lives as usual, we give the, we send a message to Washington that we're okay with whatever they say,
exactly.
You know, and they don't pay attention when we write petitions, they don't pay attention when almost 2 million
right.
showed up in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't, our phone calls mean nothing. 92% of them say no bailouts, and they still go ahead and do whatever they want.
Right.
So the whole idea is to get them to understand that they work for us. Our government is supposed to serve us and not as the main course for their greed.
Mm-hmm. They're misrepresenting us, actually.
There are misrepresentatives.
In a very
exactly.
big way.
And so it started off as a monthly boycott, and we'll get back to a monthly economic boycott the next 15th, because this is only the start of a groundswell of we the people all over starting to realize that we have the power. We just have to remember, and there are over 300 million of us in the United States and 6 billion globally. We've all been lied to, stolen from, manipulated. Our lands have been taken. Some of our ancestors and people in our family have been murdered.
Oh,
we
sure.
spend over $1 billion a week on war using depleted uranium.
$1 billion a week?
On war.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that high. $1 billion
a week. Last year, more
week,
active military committed
suicide. And that comes from our
income
tax.
They committed suicide or were suicided, as in the case of Pat Tillman, then were actually killed in active duty in Iraq.
Now,
if we're doing such a good thing over there, why do we have statistics like that?
Mm-hmm.
And when our servicemen and women, I'm sure you heard about the Apache helicopter video that came out where our soldiers were firing
targeting
on civilians and Reuters
yes.
newspaper, and it was murder.
Yes.
It was murder.
Pure sheer, yep. That was all over.
Yeah, and it's not...
Finally, it's coming out.
We allow that to happen. We allow that to happen. And we allow depleted uranium to happen. And the people over in Iraq, the poor people who are just trying to live their lives, the women who are pregnant now are delivering babies who are so horribly deformed, they barely even look human.
Oh, God, it's a crime.
And anyone who does not believe that, you can go on my links page and scroll down. I've got a link, or you can just Google for yourself, depleted uranium in Iraq.
Yeah.
And you can see what we are doing. War is not noble or glorious.
Mm-hmm.
War is for the benefit of the bankers.
Exactly.
Henry Kissinger said, military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns in foreign policy.
That's what they think of us.
And cannon fodder.
Yeah. And that's all the soldiers really are. And we're paying for that with our income tax. That's where the bulk of it is going.
Well, actually, the 1040 taxes that everybody thinks that they need to pay, every single cent that comes off of your individual wages goes to pay interest to the Federal Reserve on the money they loan us.
Every
that was found out during the Reagan administration when he commissioned the Grace Commission.
Amazing.
Not one penny, not one penny goes for infrastructure.
Wow.
It all pays the Federal Reserve bonuses. It pays them because they loan us money. And they don't tell us what they do with the money, and they have plenty of money to print it up and help banks. And Gordon Brown is talking about... We need a global constitution for banking government. You know, it's all a money game. So to get back to the plan, it is a money game, and we got to change the rules. There are more of us. They want our money. So if we can keep as much money and labor as possible and support from this government and from governments all across the world for four consecutive days, we can send a huge message to the offshore bankers, and we can also...
And you're recommending not per- purchasing anything for 4 days, basically keeping your children home from school, educating them about the truth of what's really going on. And you have a wealth of material on taxfree15th.com about activities to educate the people.
Yes, but actually it's corporations who we're targeting. We're not targeting the smaller shops. If you need
local
to shop,
businesses.
Shop mom and pop.
Yeah.
Now, go to like locally owned little restaurants and stuff. You know, no Starbucks. Get your coffee drinks from some little mom and pop store. And if now it's kind of late now for people to not go to work or school, but if they have heard about this and if they are staying home, there is plenty of information online to help folks understand about, number one, what it means to be a patriot.
Yeah.
And a patriot is someone who defends his or her country and her rights. You know, it's not defending our government. It's loving our country. It's loving our freedom and our rights enough to defend our rights, our freedom, and our country from governments, from government's interference.
Mm-hmm.
And Patriots Day is Monday. So the object here was to withdraw, to take 4 days to learn about our Constitution, to learn about our God-given rights, to learn about the Articles of Freedom.
Could you say a little bit about the Articles of Freedom?
They were the vision. Well, actually, Bob Schultz, who's been recording and documenting government violations and attempting to redress grievances, which is in the Constitution. The government is supposed to answer us when we say, wait a minute, you're overstepping your boundaries. Now, he has been attempting to hold our government accountable for about 30 years, and he's been blown off every time. So he had a vision of another Congress, a Continental Congress 2009, which was formed last year and met in November. And they came up with a beautiful document, and this is the Articles of Freedom. Now, there's a website called articlesoffreedom.us. You can also find links on my site at taxfree15.com. And what it does is it just lays out all the constitutional violations. It lays out the remedies for them as well, because it is our servant government. And on Monday, all across America, starting, I believe, at 12 o'clock Pacific, although let me make sure here, they're going to serve the articles simultaneously all across the country at state capitals, and there will be gatherings all across the country so that we can have a record of the people of the United States standing behind the Continental Congress, which was totally a wonderful and necessary group of American heroes who got together and documented all this and spent their own time and their own money to help bring about the changes that we need, you know, to help free up government and get us back to the basics. So it's important to learn about them.
And
I'm going to be spending some time during these next days learning about them as well.
I tried to print them online, and I was unable to. I don't know why. I was blocked because I wanted to have them and discuss them a bit with you. But my co-host just arrived, and his name is Alan. Alan.
Hi. Glad to be here.
This is Karen Tostado Quinn.
Quinto Stato.
Sorry.
Just Karen.
Karen. So we were
much
talking
easier.
About the Articles of Freedom, and what are some of them?
Well, they document a lot of the violations. I'm not an expert in the Constitution. I'm not an expert in politics. I'm just a motivated individual who recognizes that we've got government gone wild and we've got to stop supporting it. Personally, I would be just as happy to get back to common law, which is fulfill your agreements and don't encroach upon anybody else's ability to do exactly that same thing. We all have that guidance system built right inside of us. It comes with our physical bodies. We know when we're doing right. We know when we're doing wrong. There's also a book called The Four Agreements that I really try and live my life by.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
And I'm not always successful, but I try. And that's simply be impeccable with your word. Don't take anything personally. Don't make assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And always do your best, knowing that your best will change depending on if you're sick, if you're healthy, if you've been partying. You know, but we can always start over again.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who are really into the legality, mm-hmm. the Articles of Freedom, they list the IRS issue in there, which mm-hmm. is something we all really need to pay attention to in order to make any changes, because the IRS is getting ready to hire 16,500 more agents.
No. Oh,
and instead of going after the big corporations,
they'll be coming after
they're
us.
Going after people like a friend of mine who is on disability, who maybe makes $19,000, $18,000 a year. And just recently they called him up because they were worried that he might have made more than he should in 2008. Now, this is a man on disability who has physical problems that limit him from being able to work, and yet mm-hmm. they want to, they're mailing him information now so that they can make sure that he pays up if he owes them money.
It's outrageous.
Now, I've always thought that the most effective civil resistance we could do would be tax resistance. I know my parents were actually war tax resistors when I was a baby and or young. But most of the time when people do that, it isn't very effective because they just take the money anyway, or the repression.
And you can get arrested.
So,
interest
intense.
Can be charged.
Right. But I'm wondering if there could be some kind of effective campaign. Certainly there would be a reaction and repression, but where people all agreed together a certain number, whether it's 50,000 or however many, to all refuse together and start a big movement.
We need millions. We need millions,
yeah.
And the movement has already started. And so right now, we have to stay within this. It's criminal, but if you're not careful, you'll be taken down individually. Until
exactly.
we get it into the consciousness of the people that these 1040 taxes go strictly to the privately owned Federal Reserve, until they start educating themselves. And then when we look with one voice, I think that each and every one of the over 300 million of us here has a vested interest in this one issue alone. And we need to focus on it. We need to hold them accountable. Now, support for the Articles of Freedom will do that. Also, Tom Cryer at truthattack.org, you know, he is instrumental in this. We need the masses of people who, in my opinion, now, I know that folks are out there today and they're thinking that a political party will save them.
No.
In my opinion, it's kind of like lining up to say, get me a seat on the Titanic.
Right.
It's a sinking proposition. Until we take away personhood status from corporations,
yeah.
until we hold them accountable for their externalities, until we completely throw out lobbyists, until we take away voting machines, until we take all those great big bills that are too big for them to read, but they sign them and hold us accountable, until we build mm-hmm. a nice bonfire with those and start over just with common law and common sense, we're going to continue to be stripped. They want us chipped, dipped, and stripped of all of our rights.
Yes.
And we've got to understand this, folks. The agenda of the New World Order is generations old. This has been a long time mm-hmm. in the planning. And you cannot have global government if you have a strong country like the United States. Now, unfortunately, they're more of the dis-United States.
Mm-hmm.
But Americans all across this country and people all across the world are subject to the same criminal dominant minority in the background.
I think we've been lulled into a false sense of security, and people are slowly waking up because the conditions have gotten very serious. And our freedom with accountability and our own involvement is going to take some doing to reclaim already. I agree with you, Karen. It's very serious.
It is.
In so many,
you know, and it's funny,
care,
I say,
healthcare.
A lot of the time I say we've been lulled into a false sense of security.
We have.
Exactly. So let me quickly get, or do we have breaks during this time, or is it just
we
a commercial
talk,
free?
The only break, in fact, I'd just like to say something. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM, and we're speaking with Karen Tostado Quinn.
You still reverse it.
Oh, Karen Quinn Tostado. Karen, your name.
It'll be much easier.
Tax Free 15th. Oh, I have four interviews today. But anyway, let's get back to this. How serious the situation is.
Well,
and what
it is,
we're up
so
against.
We need to get their attention. And the time, folks, for freedom to be passed down to us without our individual participation and sacrifice has passed. We need to stand for our freedom. We need to become involved in assuring our freedom, because freedom means the ability to agree with the mandates of government. None of us are agreeing with this. We're not free.
Anymore.
We're all debt slaves, and our unborn descendants are debt slaves, down to our great-great-great-grandchildren's great-great-great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
We better wake up and do something about this. So even though we're already into the strike now, okay, number one is no work and no school. And I know folks are out there already at work and they're at school, and a lot of people haven't heard of this yet, but this is going to start to resonate. This is the seed that begins it. This is that idea that now has been unleashed from the Pandora's box, and people all over the world are going to be coming together as we grow. So, and if for the folks who already are at work and they are at school, you know, it's okay, because you can participate in the other steps. And step number two is the most important one, or one of the most important ones, and it's mm-hmm. no shopping at corporate stores.
Mm-hmm.
Don't eat lunch at McDonald's. Don't buy your coffee at Starbucks. Don't buy anything online from a corporate store. If you go to a smaller, privately owned website, buy from them. We've got to start shopping American.
We do.
We really, really do. And we have told folks to plan ahead for medications, gas, and food. And if you need to shop, go to mom and pops.
Yeah.
That's where we need to spend our money, within our communities.
And there's a push in Santa Cruz to shop locally. We've been doing it for years now, and it is making a difference. And
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is.
So
the third step
mm-hmm.
is, okay, don't buy, and then you got don't comply. Put your savings in locally owned banks or hard
mm-hmm.
assets, or leave only what you need to cover monthly bills. Work at getting off the grid and forming co-ops within your communities. Corporations, again, are who we target. We need each other, folks. We need each other. And right now, about 3 weeks ago, I heard Paul Craig Roberts talking about the real rate. If you look at the number of unemployed, underemployed, and folks who cannot pay their monthly bills, the real number is up to 40%.
Oh.
Now, those people all have skills. They can do something. You know, unfortunately, some of those people can only eat crappy food and watch TV, and those are the people who will suffer the most.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can wake up and recognize that some of us can build things, some of us
mm-hmm.
are good at farming, some of us can help each other with our computer problems,
yeah.
we can start to barter and to recognize that the only reason that things have value is because of the value we agree to give them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In Europe, for 800 years, they used tally sticks for money.
Huh.
They used a piece of wood. So we really can start to think outside the box. And then the last one, ask why. You know, folks, this is where we have to ask ourselves. I think the biggest question now to ask ourselves is, are we part of the solution or are we part of the problem?
Mm-hmm.
If we're not actively working to protect our rights and our freedoms, we're part of the problem. If we're just going to work and thinking that it'll get better and somebody else will come to save us, we're part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not making sure that we've got food, that we're prepared just in case of a so-called false flag,
mm-hmm.
I know there are provocateurs out there today. I don't have regular TV,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure exactly what's happening. I'm going to check in later. Maybe you can tell me if you've heard of something happening.
I haven't. I've been busy all day. I was going to ask you what you've heard.
No, because my big thing is I'm doing exactly now what I've been advocating people do. I already called up Peter DeFazio. I'm going to make a couple more calls, because after you ask yourself why, then the most important step is call up your misrepresentatives in Congress and tell them, I'm participating in the strike, and I want to know why you're not protecting the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know why I have to pay income tax when there isn't a law. Or can you show me the law where it says that I have to pay income tax on my private personal wages? You know, I want to know why we spend over $1 billion a week on war, and yet you're crying to me about digging deeper into my pocket while the bankers
yeah.
have made $1 billion in profit.
and continue to.
I want to know why my food is poisoned. Yeah. I want to know why chemtrails are in my sky. We have a long list of questions
we should
be asking folks.
Yeah, we certainly do. And our health care has gone downhill, and now we're going to be mandated to purchase it.
And the wars are the biggest thing, obviously. I mean, they are taking all our precious resources and making profits for a few people, but pretty much just creating havoc for everyone and wasting resources.
That's the plan. That's the plan. And we bought into it, and we keep buying into it, and we don't recognize that it is the plan, and it's all about bankers' profit, consolidation of power, and global government.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with righteousness and supposed, oh, these guys are out to get us, and look at these weapons of mass destruction that were never there. I don't know if you've ever seen a Bush at one of the parties that he went to, and he's all dressed up, and he's got all of his little Bush babies around him, and he says, oh, weapons of mass destruction. Well, and he leans over the podium and looks down and says, not over there. And everybody laughs.
Everybody laughs
at the expense of all those Iraqi lives,
American lives.
And also, when our soldiers, soldiers even survive, and they come back.
Oh, and they aren't even taken care of.
Get them out, and they live on the curb, and they don't get health benefits. And if you haven't seen a Vietnam vet or two walking around wondering what side is up, and now Iraqi vets who come back and who are just messed up people because they see what's really happening that we allow through our civil obedience.
So what do you recommend as the most effective? I mean, my concern is since the media is so controlled and we haven't been able to reach 90% of the people often, how do we find a simple way to that people can understand, where they can see very clearly, very quickly, how they're being exploited, and how we can all do this together?
Education is the key. Education is really the key. And there are so many people out there still who refuse to look at 9/11 and think that they like to say that the truthers, you know, like it's an insult or something. They throw that out there because they don't have the courage to actually look for themselves. And what I try and do is just unite people. We all know something's wrong in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all need to find out more about it. How about watching America Freedom to Fascism? Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yes. We had many copies of it that we distributed here in
Santa Cruz.
Yeah,
and it's linked right there on the front page of taxfree15.com. I encourage people to go there. And I encourage them now as well to ask themselves, look, I know you feel strongly about this. I hear your anger, you know, but have you actually researched the position you're taking? Have you looked behind it? Have you thought about, you know, how could an airplane leave a round hole in the Pentagon? You know, have you thought about those towers just melting down?
I have encountered difficulty really questioning people with that rationality. I think they're afraid to acknowledge,
I've had several people tell me, well, I just couldn't believe the government would do that, or I just can't believe it. And I'm like, well, why don't you look at the evidence? No.
Yeah, it's that, and, you know, well, look, I tell you, you can believe that this country's going in the toilet. Well, if you want to find out why, then you need to get over that, or not.
I agree.
You know, and I think also that we really need to push our politicians, because we've allowed their ignorance to become our burden, and that's not the way it is. Any politician who doesn't want to look into 9/11 is not worth holding office and should not be there.
I agree.
We need to be accountable. And it has to start
both
individually.
Sides.
And not all of us are going to get it, you know, but enough of us are going to get it to where we will make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was really, when all this started, and I had the idea before to strike. I tried one back in October because I had had the website was called TaxHoliday2009.net. And so I tried to get people to do this monthly boycott. And I was hit with a lot of apathy. There still is a lot of apathy, although it's leaving. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of people who still think that, you know, it's Republicans or the Democrats will work, and there's a lot of fear, and there are a lot of people out there who want to resort to violence. But we can't do that. Violence is just not the answer. It's the same kind of energy that got us here,
exactly.
And it just creates more anger.
And also, it's actually what the government wants, or the corporations, because it gives them an excuse. They can call
to come
it terrorism
in with their guns.
Or whatever they want to call it,
and
gives
we're
them
hopeless
an excuse
against
for the repression.
Those armaments.
Yeah.
That would be
exactly.
A tragedy in and of itself.
So we
itself.
Can't
just
play into their hands any longer,
the
and I'm hoping that today will be safe, because the best revenge is living well. We should not be worried 24 hours a day about what the government is doing and what we're going to have to do in order to pay more fines, in order to have the privilege to live in this country, while they get wealthier, while the division between the rich and the poor grows greater. I heard yesterday that we have the biggest division between the wealthy and the poor people in the on the planet.
In the Western nations, yeah, we
right
do.
Right here in this country, and we're just deluding ourselves. We've got some people who just refuse to open their eyes, but there are people who are starting
they
to.
They are, and I see what's happening in Iceland and Greece, and I wonder why we're so slow to wake up. I think it has something to do with our media, and for years we were getting wealthier and wealthier. Jobs were plentiful in my time, and it's just changed in the past, I'd say, 10 years dramatically.
But it's been part of a plan.
Yeah.
It's been part of the plan. Actually, there's a, here, let me go on the Educate page. I've got a quote here. Let me find it. But it's global. It's the global plan for a global government, and it's been around for a long time. But the good news that I do feel really good about is what this idea does is start to bring accountability back to each and every individual, because we are the ones who are the worker bees or the ants that are feeding this bloated queen. And when we finally recognize that our numbers far outweigh 300 million of us, 535 misrepresented us. Let's see, 300 million versus 535. 300 million... You know, when we start to understand the power of our numbers, and that there's no way we're going to beat these people if it comes down to a fight.
No.
There's just no way we're going to do that. Now, you might be able to hold them off from your house or your property for 5 minutes, but if we get into a real major fight, there's no way we'll win. Everyone loses. That's not what we want. That's what they want. We got to be smarter this time. This time, we have to have a peaceful evolution. Revolutionary thinking and the resolution to see it through. Got
to
come at it with a different angle. It's the 21st century, and it's time for us to become adults of God, not children of God. We need to be adults of God.
I'm with you.
Let me find this quote here, because it's...
And this is a way to channel the fear and the anger. And as people come out and get to know one another and realize that we are all in this together, start having community gardens, buying locally, bartering, because we have an economic collapse, people still have crafts, they have gifts, their talents that they can offer in exchange.
Right. Okay, now here, this is one from Paul Warburg, who was a Council on Foreign Relations member and architect of the privately owned Federal Reserve. So, you know, the Federal Reserve came into being in 1913.
Sure.
Here's what he says. We will have world government whether or not we like it. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent.
Mm. Great.
There's
quote.
One. At now, here's another one that this is by Franklin Roosevelt. The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government since the days of Andrew Jackson.
Yep.
Here's another one. In politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can be sure we planned it that way. These are all quotes on the Educate page, folks. And there's another one here by Henry Ford. It is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning.
Certainly, as soon as something rolls off the presses.
Ford was quite an ally with some of the Nazis, too. So.
Yeah. Oh, man,
sure. Well, Prescott Bush, you know, the grandfather of George Bush and father of the other George Bush, helped finance Hitler. The Wall Street boys helped finance Hitler.
Well,
so did the Vatican.
The Bush
We've
family.
Been deceived on so many levels. It's pretty unbelievable, actually. And so that's why people have such a difficult time. Once you start down this rabbit hole, it is a wild ride.
Karen, I want to ask you, what woke you up? What were some of your experiences?
Well, I never have liked a bully. I never have liked a bully. I just cannot abide a bully. And then I got sick. I was eating crappy food. I knew it wasn't good for me, but I didn't know how bad it was. So I had a pretty serious health challenge, and I learned about a lot of the toxins in my food. I learned how it was a lot worse than I initially had suspected.
Uh-huh.
Then I lost my beloved mother and father.
Oops.
Mistakes. I also, after that...
I'm sorry, you lost your parents to... There was a...
Malpractice or...
Oh,
medical?
If you hang on... Can you hang on 1 second,
sure.
Please? I'm sorry.
I think she has call waiting. I think she said medical system. She lost her. It wasn't medical now. Maybe. Yeah, I think that's what she said. So there must have been medical malpractice.
Well, we'll find out.
I suspect that happened to my mother.
Hi, sorry.
Hi.
I haven't yet learned how to figure out how to turn off that when somebody calls and I'm in the middle of a show. Well, that's what you get when you're live.
Yes, that's true. And you were saying that your parents or your mother suffered from the medical system.
They say that in this country, medical mistakes are responsible for either the number 3 or number 4 cause of death. I believe it is the number 1 cause of death.
I do too.
Heart disease and cancer can be cured by alternative means, but they don't want us knowing that either, which is why they're limiting our access to those kinds of treatments.
Both my parents also died because of that kind of... I mean, I can't say for sure that they would have survived, but there was certainly the kind of care that we get is not adequate at all.
It's very substandard. It's very substandard. And it is actually, you know, they don't want us around. They don't want us around. And so... we have to start recognizing that, and it was really, I'm sure it was painful for you as well.
Oh, it was.
And because you're kind of helpless, and I knew enough to know that it was wrong, but still you have to support what your parents decide to go for.
My mother went in for radiology and chemotherapy, and that was it.
And the feeling of helplessness. You're so helpless there. And then, too, to look at the obesity in the hospital staff is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And the food they serve as well. I mean, come on, folks. If you want to really get people well, where are the steamers and the juicers and the whole fresh fruits and vegetables and grains instead of mystery meat and high fructose corn syrup and all the crap? You know, it's like, you have cancer. Let's tell you to go home, put on some weight, so, you know, eat cakes and ice cream and all that.
You'll
and sugar feeds cancer.
Come on in for a dose of radiology and chemotherapy, and we'll kill off all your healthy cells, and you'll be fine. You lose all your hair in addition.
Then
we'll have support groups for you in the grief process.
So, anyway, then my husband discovered that 9/11 was an inside job. And we both, you know, that's not something that you really want to think about.
Sure.
I mean, it's the last thing we wanted to consider. But when you really started looking at it, you know, you can't go back. You can't go back, and you can't just put it in a closet, because it is why we're here. Mm-hmm. It is why we're here. It is what happened that brought us to this particular moment, and all of the war and everything was right about that. The Patriot Act was waiting in the wings.
The Patriot Act, yes, we lost most of our freedoms then.
We did. So,
and it was all planned for quite a while.
Yeah, well, so then that started, and I had been trying to tell people during that time about genetic engineering and the food, and nobody wanted to listen to me. They all thought I was crazy. They all thought that it was just absolutely not worth their time, and they couldn't believe it either. They couldn't believe it either. And so they didn't want to hear about it, and it drove me crazy because I wanted to tell them, and I'd be really angry, and they wouldn't want to hear it. And so finally, we just kind of pulled out of the system for a while. We would try and talk to people. You would bring up 9/11, and it can still stop a dinner party flat in a minute because people are just that afraid and uptight to really look for the truth.
I've done that many times.
Yeah, and then I learned that 1040 income taxes were voluntary. And then just more and more, and about almost a year and a half ago with the bailouts, the first bailouts, right around Christmas time, when we all said no and Congress just blew us off, you know. So I figured I had to do something. And that's when I got the idea of the tax holiday 2009.net. And initially I wanted to tell people, hey, don't pay your taxes. But I learned very quickly you really can't do that. They're too well armed. It's the mafia. So instead, I don't do that, you know, until we get the numbers. But we need to educate ourselves first, and then our numbers will follow. So what happened then was just kind of an evolution of trying to get it off the ground last year, and then trying to see if I could pull together a strike in October, and then it didn't work. And then in January, I thought, well, look, what am I going to do here? Do I just live my life and be grateful for living my life and try and stay out of the way? Or do I raise my voice and do something? And so I thought, well, let me call in. And I called in Michael Rivero on whatreallyhappened.com. And I started to... Pardon?
No, I'm saying yes.
Yeah. And I talked about the boycott. And he said, well, I wouldn't support a boycott, but I would a strike. So I hung up. And I slept on it, and when my feet hit the floor the next morning, it was like, that's it, we have to strike. And then I looked up, and the 15th was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I thought, you know, there you go, that's perfect. And so that started that ball rolling. I threw the dates out there. I called up Michael, told him, okay, we're on. He was supportive. And then I found out from Bob Schultz that the Articles of Freedom were being served on Patriots Day, which was that Monday. And I thought, well, that works perfectly. And it had already actually started. And so then I've been promoting also the articles and to learn what it is to be a patriot and to open it up because it really is a global issue.
And I like what you say, peaceful evolution, and the resolution will carry it through. Where do we go from here? That's going to be evolving, and everyone can participate in that.
Yes,
well, they can still keep their money now and just shop locally. And I'll tell you what is very exciting to me and why I feel so good today, because I've had people tell me, okay, well, you're crazy, and, you know, that's not new to me. And I'm not taking things personally anymore. I'm really doing my best to not make assumptions. And so I thought, well, am I just kind of putting my head on a chopping block here? And I realized, no, I'm not.
No, you're not.
My feet have found this path that I've been compelled to walk. I have an entertainment background. I don't have a problem speaking out. I don't really want to be a politician. I'd much rather come from I'm coming from a spiritual place anyway. And I'd rather sing songs and make jewelry and hang out and enjoy my life and read books. But I just know too much to be silent. And it's too dangerous now to be silent.
It's
more dangerous now to speak out. Yeah. But until we get enough of us, then there is no future.
There still is a lot of apathy and fear, and you're working to change. I'm sorry, Alan, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to ask, I know that we're probably all familiar with Naomi Klein and the shock doctrine, but I was an activist for years and years, and we just see that the government, you know, they have billions of dollars, but they were always one step ahead of us. There'd be some thing that would just completely flatten us and disable the movement, and that they've used this, been very sophisticated about using the crises and using the things that they create, the problems, to actually reinforce the repression and all the things that they're doing and convince people to go along with it. But I'm seeing also how we also have to be really aware of the crises and the opportunities, this opportunity being in the Chinese character, crisis as being danger and opportunity. And that if we could see, I don't know if you have any ideas about that, about, you know, as things fall apart, how that will wake people up, how we can use those openings to connect with people and actually build that movement.
Well, that's what we're doing now, is really starting the groundswell. And all the people also in the Tea Parties, all the people who know something is wrong, we're not walking on solid tyranny now. It's getting close. That's what they'd like it to be. But I feel a groundswell that will be building to a tidal wave when we can really wash away the corruption, when we, the people, rise to the occasion. And it is about paying attention, and it's about seeing that there's more here to the story. And nothing spells tyranny like the kinds of actions that they're doing now with forcing the health care bill and forcing all the rest of this down our throats while they're basically Bernanke, you know, flips us off and says, sorry, I got to go to a meeting now and decide how to spend your money, how to take more of your money. So the more that we come together and start building communities, see, my vision, ultimately, my goal for this strike that I'm hoping people will come to, instead of getting out in the streets and spending the money and the gas and the time and the effort to go to some place and try and promote or shore up a broken system, I think, to me, it makes much more sense to, I don't want to be anywhere near a provocateur. I don't want to spend all the money and time to go to a great big huge rally and stand in the middle of 3 million people, because I'd be the one person in the middle that would have to go to the bathroom right when the key speaker came up. I mean, it is just, that would be my luck, you know. And then there'd be a huge line. I'm sorry, folks, I'm too old for that.
You may see the in there, it's no fun coming around on there. Motorcycles, and you might be in the middle of that. I mean, I agree with you. I've been to many demonstrations, and they're getting too dangerous.
But pulling back, living well, living our lives.
Yes.
These 4 days are supposed to be about educating ourselves and about thinking, more importantly, about what are we going to do to protect our futures. Individually, do we have storable food? Do we have water filters? Do we have a garden that we can get started? You know, what are we going to do to make sure that if a false flag happens, and there are a lot of people there who believe that it's inevitable, and if it happens, what are we going to do? Plus, the 19th, Patriots Day, unfortunately, is the anniversary of Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing. And these are also two events.
How ironic.
It's unfortunate because also those in power, at the risk of sounding very far out there, they're into satanic rituals. They're into very, very dark stuff. And this begins a 13-day blood ritual sacrifice to the beast.
Wait, now, who is this exactly that's into this?
Pardon?
Who's into the satanic ritual?
The people in power are
the
people behind the scenes, Rothschilds, Rockefellers, the people who go to Skull and Bones, who graduate from Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, which is a bit from your neck of the woods.
It is.
I actually had some personal experience of I knew some from some ceremonial groups of people. We'll just be anonymous, but they were. Their parents worked for some of the Livermore Laboratory, the nuclear laboratories, and some of the military installations, and some of them had been victimized by satanic abuse, and that they knew there were different groups within those organizations, or, you know, offshoots, whatever, but that were so. It's not as uncommon.
Now, the history of Santa Cruz has. I had someone on talking about the Mexican history of Santa Cruz, and she spoke at length about the Bingo Boys and the Bush family being involved in that. So I know what you're talking about.
The Bush family is a horrible Bush crime family.
Yes.
And let me read you this, because you'll also find then, if you are interested in that, and I tell you, and for your listeners too, it might be a lot if you can look. Now, or what I do is I look at what I learn as information.
Yeah.
I believe our spirits are eternal, that the divine essence that runs through each and everything and gives life to the universe is within us. We are the same. We will go beyond this lifetime.
I agree with you.
Firmly,
Karen.
I don't know. I just believe that very much so. I don't try
also.
And put a label on God. I'm happy saying the word God Jesus, it works for me, but I know it doesn't work for all people.
To me, it's a great
but
mystery.
I try to be inclusive.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not smart enough to figure out which Bible is the right Bible.
No, I just call it the great mystery, and it's all around us.
It is all around us, and it's something that I embrace. And the more I let go of having to pigeonhole or label or box,
yeah.
more the better off I am. And these guys, the criminals who belong to Bohemian Grove, which will be taking place, I think it's July, up there in the redwoods and stuff there in Northern California.
Yes.
This is from, I believe I took it from The Secret Behind Secret Societies, which is also right there in, it's in the links page. It's on the links page. If you scroll down, you'll get some eye-opening information there. I've tried to make the tax-free site, and with my webmasters, we've tried to put a lot of information on there because we want to encourage people to have a spot where they can go back and they can find out things that I'm learning and that we know and we should know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not easy things, folks, but the more we know, and if we look at it again as information and know that all things pass and that when we come together, I mean, physics proved that when we think about things, we can change our world. We can affect our world. People can meditate on peace and come together and do it in a focused meditation and put it out to a certain area, and they can document that crime goes down. Greg Braden talks about this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, so he does.
My personal belief, and I guess it's in Santa Cruz, you know, I feel I can more freely talk about this, but
you
is
can.
That way back when, the people who wanted to be in power recognized that we all have that divine connection and we would recognize it. So before we could explore that and explore our own power, they had to give us a label, they had to give us a direction,
right.
they had to give us books, rules, and regulations in order to keep us from thinking for ourselves because
mm-hmm.
they wanted to think for us. They want to control us. They feed off of that. They're like emotional vampires.
Yeah, and it's a way to dampen our awareness, to stifle it so that
right,
it's not
right.
even
and to
coming
it.
To fruition. And it's important. That's why it's important to detach for a bit from what's going on, not watch television, not read the news for a while. Go out in nature and feel that felt sense of divine information that's coming through.
Yeah.
We all
and that's
have
where
access
I was
to
right
that.
Before I came into the call, and I haven't
oh.
gone out and had that communion since January.
Oh. Oh,
like
no,
I finally did
daily.
Again. I've been so obsessed with kind of trying
sure.
to get the word out, you know? So
well.
It was. It's wonderful to do that because I've told people, pull back, live your lives, and today
yes.
I went, I'm doing it. The sun is shining for the first day really in months. It's a beautiful day. I live in a beautiful area.
And where do you live
I look
again?
The river.
Oh.
You know, there are trees. I live up in Oregon.
Oh,
and
I
made some new friends, and I fed the horse, and I fed ducks, and you know.
That's living. That's
yeah.
Life. That's
yeah.
such enjoyment.
So anyway, I wanted to get back on this Bohemian Grove.
Mm-hmm.
This will blow your mind because it blew mine. And I thought to myself, boy, if this isn't treason for our presidents to belong to this, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
The activities of the order are directed toward changing our society, changing the world, to bring about a new world order. This will be a planned order with heavily restricted individual freedom, without constitutional protection, without national boundaries or cultural distinction. How do you like that?
It yeah. doesn't surprise me.
And it's been going on. I remember protesting up there 30 years ago, so it's been going on a long time.
And it just keeps growing. Oops.
Excuse me. That's okay. I had my phone call. You're entitled.
Oh, dear. Excuse me. I thought I had that on.
What, is there a protest happening up at Bohemian Grove, or is that? Is it just for
they were the last I heard about it, they were in or installing helicopter pads so they no longer have to be seen by the little people when
mm-hmm.
they come in there. And they've got the strangest escapades going on there, too. And Skull and Bones members. Skull and Bones members have to lie in a coffin and have some pretty strange things happen while they are in there. And that is why it made a lot more sense realize that Kerry was a Skull and Bones member,
right.
And so was George Bush.
Oh, gosh,
so basically, Skull and Bones is in power in the White House.
Yes.
You know, when Kerry just dropped out so quickly.
Karen, mm-hmm. We have run the gamut of topics here. We've jumped from
one
thing to another, but it's been
it's fascinating.
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's and it's a beautiful day.
It is. If you ever come down here, I'd love to interview you live as well. But
well, I hope I'll be live. And
I mean, here in our little basement studio.
Productive.
But Karen, before we go, what would you like to share with our listeners? Because we're going to have to wrap it up. I have someone else calling in.
Okay, really quickly, what
yes.
I'd like to say is that I have had contact from people in Germany. Our site, between our site in the UK and our site here, we are in the top 500,000 visited websites globally. This is not the end of it. There's an economic boycott on the 15th of next month.
Mm-hmm.
And forgive me, I thought we were on for the 2 hours, so I just got
no.
comfortable. But
oh,
yeah, the strike
wish.
Is real, folks. It's a way to educate
yeah.
yourself, and it's a way to come together peacefully, just withdraw support,
mm-hmm.
get out of the way of government before they run all of us over. Just pull back out of the way, pull your money out, start to live your life, start to build community, come together and support one another. Power to the people through peaceful unity.
Thank you. And thank you for your inspiration and the fire that you are. And I'm going to say your name
well,
correctly
you.
Now.
I guess next I should ask how long so I can zip it up.
Well, we'll have you on again. Because don't you want people to strike on the 15th of every month?
Yes. Well,
yes.
At least an economic
That's
boycott. And
an
stay
economic
tuned
boycott.
Because we're going to have a bigger strike coming. I know we are.
I know we are, too.
Do you want to repeat the conference call numbers? Or?
I want to repeat. Go ahead.
The website is taxfree15.com.
Mm-hmm.
We do have conference calls, although they're going to be cut down to Saturdays only. Saturday morning, 11 a.m. Pacific. And the telephone number is on the website, but I'll quickly give it 712-775-7200.
Great.
712-775-7200, and the passcode is 431-669-pound.
And the website is taxfree15.com.
And in the UK, it's taxfree15.org.uk.
Great. Wonderful. And I'm going to say your name correctly, Karen. Karen Quinn Tostado. Thank
Got
you.
Got it, girlfriend.
So much. This has been wealth of information and a lot of wisdom thrown in. So we're going to get ready for our next guest now. We have to move right along, but thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it was Karen Quinn Tostado, Tax-Free 15, and we're going to be learning more about taxes and reimagining money now. I'm going to be getting a hold of John Bloom, and he is the author of The Genius of Money. In the meantime, we're going to listen to a little bit of Lorena McKennitt. was Lorena McKinnitt, and we now have John Bloom, and he is the director of the organizational culture at RSF. And as part of his work there, he's been developing the Transforming Money Collaborative, as well as other educational programs that address the intersection of money and spirit in both personal and social transformation. And he is the author of The Genius of Money, and it's a collection, fascinating collection of essays and interviews, subtitled Reimagining the Financial World. John, are you with us?
There.
John, hi. Whoops, we still have this music. There. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
I couldn't hear it on my end. Oh. Well, how did you ever come to write this book? It's so all-encompassing. It really forced me to look at my relationship, not just with money, but the identity that I derive from being part of such a consumer-oriented culture.
Well, I would say that the book was the result of a personal journey, and I made a commitment to that personal journey because, as you mentioned, my title is Director of Organizational Culture, which I do within our own organization, but also work with many other not-for-profits and other organizations in helping them be effective in delivering their mission. And what I found was going to work with these organizations, incredibly passionate, visionary leaders who could explain how they were so able to transform the world and the work that they were doing, and it would be very inspiring. And then we would have to come to the table and sit down and start talking about budgets and salaries and fundraising. And the same people would be at the table, but it would be a different set of personalities. And that actually bothered me, because the pattern that I experienced was that those same organizations, while being visionary and passionate, also were short of the resources that they needed to get their work done.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense was that whatever unprocessed work around money and finance in the social sphere that was there energetically at the table, you know, that had been different than more to the outward passionate part, was also creating a kind of resistance to receiving the resources that were needed.
Mm-hmm.
So from there I went to saying, well, then I guess the real work to transform organizations is to get into work around money and into the deeper conversations around money. And
mm-hmm.
then I had to decide, if I really want to do that, I better do that work myself. And so the book really resulted in, and from the work I did on myself, my own sort of personal journey, because I felt I just needed to do that level of exploration before I could work with either anyone else or any other organization to invite them on the journey as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what have you discovered in that process?
Two things. One, I would say that I've discovered that my theory was actually correct. And second, that I was actually serving organizations particularly, and individuals, to have conversations that they really wanted to have but didn't necessarily know how to have them. So it wasn't like I would go and say, now you have to go talk about money, by just entering gently into people's own biographies
mm-hmm.
Around money and beginning to share those biographies, particularly focused around their childhood and the cultures that they grew up in and how their attitudes were formed around money, and sharing those stories with each other,
mm-hmm.
People began to see each other differently. And also to understand how the energy that they were bringing to some of those other decisions made more sense in the context of their personal biographies. And then they could sort of become more of a sympathetic group. and therefore more able to sort of move along. And also in working with schools, I realized that those individuals who had not necessarily wanted to or had by necessity launched into their own work around money were standing in front of children and inadvertently sort of teaching them that it's okay not to address questions of money as well.
John,
I mean, just on an internal, yeah.
This is Teresa Caraggio. Nice to meet you. I have a radio show called Third Paradigm. And as Janaea mentioned to you, I just finished my taxes an hour ago, and I told her that I did stop to take a bath before I came, having reached that pit of personal hygiene that I allow myself once a year.
Is that cleansing from the taxes?
I think so. I think, you know, we should have a spiritual ablution. I'm not necessarily feeling the spirituality of money at this moment. But I'd like to examine that concept, because I deal very much in my show with both religion and spirituality, and also with money and economics. And if I were to define spirituality, it starts with the concept that we're all equal, which would be a prerequisite to seeing that we're all one. When I look at my taxes, and I did an analysis of this on my last show, that it's very obvious to me that the purpose of taxation is to centralize power. That every time a dollar circulates, if you add up the average federal income tax, state income tax, and FICA between the employer and the employee portion, that's 46%. Then you add in sales tax, then you add in property tax, you add in utility taxes, you're easily up to 50%. So if every time a dollar circulates, half of it or more bleeds out of our community and goes to some centralized power, how are we ever going to fund a government to get that government to do what we want it to do with it?
Hmm. Well, that's a very loaded question. I'm not sure I want to answer it absolutely directly, but I would like to, since it's tax day, maybe frame taxes in a slightly different way than you had framed it. Not that I necessarily disagree with anything you said, but let me backtrack and suggest that actually taxes are, you're not really purchasing anything with taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're certainly not lending it to the government because you know you're never going to get it back. So the conclusion is actually taxes are a form of gift, mandatory gift, because if you don't pay them, you know, there's all sorts of issues around that. But it's your mandatory gift, your contribution to the Commonwealth to make it run in a way. So that's a very somewhat abstract and idealistic picture of what taxes are. But in fact, they are a kind of a defined contribution that you make. So, in a way, you're charging yourself those gifts through your representative government, if the government is you. That, of course, opens up a whole other can of worms and discussion.
The only piece I would add to that is that I think it's a gift to the wealthiest 0.0001% of the people in the world, and I'm not sure those are the people I want to give my money to.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not so much the gift side as the mandatory side.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Huh. You know, Anne Marie is on the phone right now, and
okay.
She doesn't have much time, so I definitely want to get back to this discussion, but there are two questions that she'd like to ask you, and for our listeners, this is Anne Marie Sayre. She is the California matriarch of, I think, the Indians, and she lives in Indian Canyon and Hollister, and it is through Anne Marie that I learned about your book. A bunch of us went down to the canyon, started looking at it. She had just come back from the Emergence Conference, and we just picked up gems, each one of us, and it was so appropriate to where we were in our thoughts and our lives. But she's right here. Anne Marie, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Oh, great.
Greetings. Nice to hear your voice.
John Bloom, I absolutely absolutely loved your book.
Oh, well, thank you.
The Genius of Money. You are, when I first met you, I just felt, now here is a man that has the appearance of being truly brilliant. And you did confirm that with this book. You did a marvelous job.
You remember what I said when you said that, which is the appearances can be deceiving.
That's exactly what you said, quote, unquote.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. John, with your interview that you had with Charles Terry, what an amazing man he presented himself to be.
Well, he's an extraordinary person.
Yeah. Well, what are you most impressed with him?
Well, first, I would say that he was so clear in his own mission in life to sort of step off the sort of high-power legal circuit and then really take on the transformative work that ended up being the Youth Project in New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to stay with the project as long as he did, it was called The Door, and to stay with that project for the extended period of time, that's a kind of passion and commitment that is, I think, connected to transformation. Anybody who, you know, wants to create a new model or a new paradigm and thinks it can happen in, you know, 20 seconds or so, it doesn't really work that way. It takes sort of a constant, steady vision. And I find that, I found in him that same vision. It's still operative, even though, you know, he moved on to the Rockefeller Foundation and is now actually found some deep passion in working in Africa with youth there. So, yeah, that's a kind of narrative, biographical through thread that I think is very powerful.
You know, I truly believe it's following your passion. That's the eternal thread.
Right. Well, and actually staying committed to that, even though one sometimes runs into adversity, and it isn't always easy.
Yeah, your passion sucks you in. You have no choice but to stay committed. Truly. He found the parallel between water and money.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees money similar as water, as a natural resource that flows, and that doesn't necessarily belong to anyone, but it exists to serve everyone. Is your take on money similar?
I'm going to say the metaphor that I certainly agree with the flow. No question in my mind about that. And as I've come to study water more, because it's such a powerful issue in the world, I see a great deal of value in first of all understanding its role as in the commons.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to think of money circulating more like blood.
Water is the blood of the earth.
That is true. So that's the parallel, or at least the metaphoric parallel. So in that sense, absolutely. From a more, and again, this is my lack of understanding, perhaps, of water, which I'm getting to know better. The thing about blood is that it only works so long as it's moving, and also it has both an expansion, contraction, and a living and a dying function that are pretty evident. And the dying part, right, the release of oxygen and then coming back and being renewed, is a somewhat more immediate parallel to the dollars, because it's a closed system. And one, the Earth is, of course, a contained system as well. So if you go out to the really macro level, I think it actually works. It fits. But we certainly see the circulation of the human blood in a fairly contained way.
You know,
and it's self-renewing.
Our language, our native language, which is Mutsum, blood is Rama. And Rama, water is Rama. And Rama is not just H2O. But it's the creek that contains the water. It's the movement of the water.
Mm.
It's the flow. It's the sound of the water. They're one and inseparable.
But that is in whole. It's in whole system.
That is correct.
Yeah.
John,
money. I think money needs to be seen in whole system rather than as a thing. So in that sense, the metaphor of any kind of movement and flow and fluidity in the context of a system is, I think, helpful.
Well, John, I cannot tell you how much I truly, truly enjoyed The Genius of Money that you wrote, John Bloom. I feel very, very honored to have met you, and I want to thank you so very much for your book.
Well, thank you for reading it and absorbing it and taking it in and appreciating it.
You did a brilliant job, John.
Well, John, you really did. We spent an afternoon, as I told you, just briefly going over it because there was so much to go over. And we just took a paragraph and shared it, and it just opened up our awareness to money, natural resources, how we live our lives, the opportunity to reflect. It's truly transformative. And I love the chapter on the topography of transactions. I'd like to get into that, too.
Yeah, that was, when one reflects on one's own experience.
Yes.
And then you try to develop an objective relationship to that, at least objective enough so that you can describe it. And then on top of that, expect somebody else to understand that description. It's a big challenge, but I just felt that it was important to, if nothing else for myself, to define, first of all, that not all money is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And to think of it all as one singular piece and it's the same no matter what is not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand that our inwardly, the way we use the money has a different soul quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I go to buy something, to purchase something, that, usually is driven by a need or a desire, and I don't really need to have a human relationship to do that. I mean, I
mm-hmm.
can go to a store and do self-checkout, never have to talk to anybody.
That's
right?
One level. Yes.
Yeah, that's one level. And then when I want to borrow money or I want to lend money to someone, then
yes.
It's a whole different order because, first of all, I want to know, so who are you that you want me to lend to you? Do I trust you? Am I going to get paid back? What kind of interest should that be, or should I have it at no interest at all? And we're going to be in relationship for whatever the time period is that we agree upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that, from a soul level, we're part of each other's story,
mm-hmm.
And we're interdependent at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that, the time quality from the purchase is instant, but when you have a loan, you actually define sort of a period of time over which the transaction will occur or continue to occur. And then in the gift side, something else happens altogether because gifts don't happen in the framework of time in the same way that loans and purchases do. You give up control of a gift, which you don't when you really are making a loan. You're not really giving up control of the money. But the gift is only a gift when you actually release control of it and it becomes transformed.
And it's up to the receiver to use it as they feel.
Exactly.
Driven.
And you don't, and you can't, you give up the sort of the right, so to speak. You give up the power or the control that it will be used in the way that you think it should be used. It has to be used according to that person's needs, desires, and of course there's always been a conversation, hopefully, and some agreement around that. But because the gift operates outside of time, so if you make a gift to, let us say, an orphanage,
mm-hmm.
and it allows the orphanage to deliver its mission, some child who's at that orphanage at the time may turn out to be a brilliant scientist, and you are connected to that happening, but not directly, and
mm-hmm.
in no way could you have predicted when that was going to happen.
And you write about intention that is set mm-hmm. with the exchange of the money.
Right.
And often when money is held in real estate or in investments, it's not circulating, it's not being used. Whereas if you give a gift, you give it away, it's being used, and therein the value of it increases. I'd never really thought of that. And it's being used, like a coat that you don't need. You give that away, and it's being used by someone who appreciates it,
exactly.
Who feels the warmth. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't always have to be money, but the value.
Well, and actually, to go back to the metaphor of blood, what happens is a gift is usually given away because I see value in it, but I can see that it's more valuable to you than it is to me,
mm-hmm.
Because I recognize that you're, you know, likely to make good use of it. So that's probably money that I don't need to meet my immediate needs. That's what gift money is. Right? I'm able to give that away. And therefore, if I don't give it away, it's going to sit around and age and, in a sense, out of disuse, die away. When I give that away, somebody uses that and expends it to meet their needs, and it's renewed. It's like the age becomes, it's like new life is brought into it.
Mm.
And that is, of course, an increase in value. Then it starts in circulation again.
John, I have a lot of friends who work on gift economies, which mm-hmm. you talk about in your blog. You probably know some of them. The charity focus people who are up in your neck of the woods?
Sure.
Yeah, Nipun Mehta.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I've always raised to them is it possible to go from a capitalist economy, which is one that favors excess, in which those who have will get more, mm-hmm. and those who have not will lose what the little they have, and go from there to a gift economy? Because what you're leaping over in the middle is a just economy, that the mm-hmm. things that we have really are not ours by right just because our money buys them. So if I give a dollar to someone on the street and they use it to go buy a can of food where the aluminum has been has caused river blindness, you know, in a country where the water is being dammed, and the food has been picked by migrant farmers who have been mistreated, and it's all being sold by Safeway, who's, you know,
sure,
so you have this. It's not really my gift to give. You know, I can't control how that gift's going to be used, but if it's in my hand, I'm going to make sure that that dollar goes to someone who's as close as I can get to a producer.
Mm-hmm. And is consistent with the values that you're trying to bring about in the world.
Right. Whether it's a producer here for my own needs or whether I'm giving it, but giving it to a producer in the third world.
Right. Yeah. And the beauty of money, of course, is that you can do that very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would say, you know, 20 years ago that was not the case, but technology's made that quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how quickly money can move. And then it becomes a matter of a will and will capacity to actually take the resources that we have rather than leaving them to accumulate and get them where they're really needed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I would say one of the issues that's behind what you said is around accumulation is there's an assumption around accumulation that if I accumulate enough, I can take care of myself. And it misses the fact that if I don't really care for the other, which is that person who's, you know, the producer in the other region, who maybe can start producing in a healthy way, that actually that's a benefit to me because there's less pollution in that water. You know, we all share the same air. We all share the same water. We share the same everything. So there's a short-sightedness in the self-interest side to that I fully agree with you on. Somehow or other, we have to realize that if we improve somebody else's life, we live in a one-world economy.
Mm-hmm.
That it's actually improving our lives to do that. But that's a huge paradigm change.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you're working to do in social finance. And can you talk a little bit about social finance?
Mm-hmm. So I would say the simplest definition of social finance because sometimes there are two words that sometimes people have a hard time seeing them together. So the simplest definition.
Yeah, that's
definition,
true.
For me, is to say that we work with finance and money in such a way that it actually supports social development, social evolution, community development. So it's really about the people and their initiative and capacity and an ability to see what needs to be done in the world, and then making sure that the capital is there to support them in getting done what they need to get done. So it's not a use of money to make more money. Mm-hmm. It's really a use of money to free up human capacity.
For education, for the arts, for the soul.
Sure. Education for the arts, to actually change the way the world works with money. Also ecological stewardship, mm-hmm. and food and agriculture. I mean, to me, those are the primary, well, those are our primary focus areas. There's certainly many other areas that need work, but we actually have long held that, you know, education is a very important piece because that's about renewing human capacities. But we quickly got to the realization that if children don't have healthy, good food to eat, they're not going to be able to think. So we have a very integrated world, and we have to look at it in the whole system.
I think, John, that what's made my taxes so complicated today is actually a project that's after your own heart. What I've been doing for the last almost year is something called Food in the Hood. Mm-hmm. And what we have is a front yard food market every Friday. And I work with students from the high school, including my daughters. We grow food in the backyard, we raise chickens, and then we cook it, and then we hand it out, and people take whatever they want, and they donate whatever they want to whatever global charity we're sponsoring that week. So when I try to take this and put it into my taxes, it doesn't fit, because taxes are set up so that, you know, if I was paying that money to a bank in mortgage interest, you know, then they'd be happy to deduct it.
Sure.
But if I'm trying to look for a way that I can partner with producers, because that's part of it too, is that I'm making long-term investments, taking the CSA concept, but taking it to a further degree where I'm saying I want 10 years of knowing that I'm going to have good fresh bread every week, a dozen eggs. And so trying to take that into another realm is something that is, I'd have to say, actively discouraged by the way that taxes are calculated.
Yeah, I wish I were a tax expert, and I'm not. So my first confession is that I'm like you. I fill out my taxes and I pay them, but I depend on others to understand how the whole system works. I know, for example, that taxes are a governmental expression of, as best as possible, around economic policy.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Clearly,
their control.
Right. So there are incentives set up, and it's structured in such a way to favor particular interests over others.
Large corporations, probably.
Well, even if I take sort of private personal taxes, they're still favor the homeowner,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, if you think about how all of that, happens, there's a lot in that structure that is, I would say, to pull no punches, rather prejudicial.
Oh, for sure.
So, and so that's a kind of a policy, and I don't know, I guess I'd have to say, it depends on your theory of change. In the sense that what you're describing to me, first of all, it's very inspiring and exciting.
Thank you.
And second of all, you're actually describing the new economy.
Ah. You write about community-supported agriculture.
Right. You're actually describing the new economy. So if you really want to live into that, of course, the old economy isn't going to get that. It just doesn't. In the same way that it doesn't, from an economic standpoint, economics doesn't know what to do with love, and it doesn't know what to do with caring.
With emotions, yeah.
it doesn't know what to do with most of the things that we actually depend on day in and day out to actually be inspired through the day.
Hmm. It's very mathematical, accounting.
Well, it's very material.
Material.
It's extremely material. It can't handle the concept of time, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you have time banks, which is a complementary currency, and time becomes a currency. But the Internal Revenue Service says, well, we can't tax that because we can't get our heads around how to set any value to it, and there's no monetary equivalence, and everybody's time is equal, and an hour is an hour. So therefore, it's not taxable.
And
I mean, I've actually seen that ruling. So there's, again, a little snapshot of this of the new economy. But you are creating a new social form.
Mm-hmm.
And my gut sense is, I mean, it's maybe paraphrasing Buckminster Fuller, you know, if you want to change the world, don't try to change the existing structure. Just build the new one until the old one just collapses. And that's what you're doing.
You are.
And by the way, the old one is you know, a little on the edge.
Yeah, I think the bad news is that the new economy is really not possible unless you happen to have a husband who has a good job. Otherwise, you can't do this, and the system isn't really set up to foster security or anything that you know, that helps with educating students, that helps build neighborhoods, that helps build food security. I'd have to take exception that that the tax code favors homeowners. Who it favors are those who are in debt. When the bank owns your house, it's mortgage interest you can deduct. But if you've paid off your mortgage, as we have, you end up being penalized for it. You get penalized in every direction.
Right, and by the way, I agree with you. That is a clarification around ownership that is a very fair recasting of what I was trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually agree with you.
But you talk about, when you're describing community-supported agriculture, a way that people can survive sustainably, and that includes the land.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that with our listeners a little bit, how it came to be? And it's outside of the system. The shareholders have an equal, they're not taking any money from the operation, the farm. They have an equal interest in its success.
Sure. It's in some ways an inversion of the concept of shareholder. In the sense that what you're really sharing in... is anybody there still?
No.
We are here.
Okay.
I think it was another line that we need to turn off.
We're going to try to
turn it off without turning off you.
I know it.
We are both aspiring Luddites, and so this sort of thing doesn't come naturally.
Hi.
Hi.
Yay.
Hi. There, you're still with us. There. Yeah, I know we're both. It's been a year.
Please
I've been doing
on.
This. Yes, continue.
So
that was Anne-Marie probably hanging up.
Yeah, so that was the concept of the CSAs.
The CSAs.
And that is an inversion of the normal framing of shareholders, which in corporate structure, the shareholders are basically the owners, and they basically call the shots in the corporate world. And in CSA, the shareholders, in a sense, are co-producers. And by that, I mean a farmer, if you're just doing it in the agriculture model, a farmer grows food, but the food is actually a byproduct of soil fertility.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmer's primary work is building the fertility of the soil, because that's actually what heals the earth and heals all of the rest of the ecosystems and the water
mm-hmm.
table and everything else that's connected with it. That, to me, is the real culturing of the land. So there's a byproduct of that, which is the food, because food is part of the renewing process as well. So a group of people who want to support that can look at the sort of annual cost of living for the farmer and agree to share that cost. So the farmer is
mm-hmm.
not facing a market situation. And the farmer is not going to go out of business if there's a bad season or otherwise. They are there and able to continue their passion and their vocation for the next season. And what that means is that the work of renewing the earth and building soil fertility never stops. There's never a need. I mean, that's always needed. I've never seen that need disappear. So the shareholders do two things. First of all, they do share in the food that is the harvest from that. But they also share in the risk of the existence of the farm. And that is, to me,
it's
that is
not
very,
all the farmer. He isn't taking the risk.
No.
And he isn't responsible for any debt that may accrue. It's shared.
That's exactly
that's
right.
The difference.
Yeah. So, and it also is, from that perspective, if the budgeting is done well, there are no externalized costs. So the price that's arrived at for that share, we'll call it the price, is actually a true price. Because no one, you know, there's no externalized costs around pollution, around otherwise. It's all present right there. So
yes.
Sometimes it, and that's totally outside what I call it. I call that market free because it's outside the marketplace.
Truly market free.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, farmers markets are wonderful, and people get to know the farmers, and it has a very human dimension to it. Less intermediation than, you know, like you go to the supermarket and it's, I don't know how many middle people there are in that. So, and yet if the farmer has a bad season and can't get to market, they have no income.
Yes.
So that's the true CSA model is quite different in that way because you're actually supporting a vocation rather than buying products.
He still has an income.
Mm-hmm.
Although it failed, you're all, that loss is shared.
Exactly.
Among many. And they get healthy food, they get to interact with who is growing the food, what the food goes into. They probably have a stake or a share, an opportunity to share in the budget, I would imagine, how it's...
Oh, yes, the budgeting process, definitely.
The budgeting process.
Yeah, I mean, I know, having been through this now about 21 years or so, the farmers never would have asked to have health insurance. But... because there was community around that said, well, wait a minute, you know, we don't want you to have to go to the doctor every time because you want to, you know, take care of yourself, but neither do we want to set you up for, you know, financial disaster. So we want to insist that you have health insurance, and we're willing to pay for that.
Wow.
As part of the share cost. So there really is a deep sort of human caring in there.
Yes.
And again, that's why I'm saying there are very few externalized costs because we're not depending on, in that sense, the farmer's not depending on public funding for their medical care,
mm-hmm.
which then makes it invisible to the shareholders. That's an externalized cost. Yeah.
I do a lot of work on Latin America and research there, and there's a real... water change that's going on in Latin America right now with the indigenous cultures talking about their cosmovision, as they call it, their worldview, and how different that is, that for them, the wealth is only land, the water,
mm-hmm.
the air.
Mm-hmm.
Here we look at, you know, we have a right to food, medicine, we have a right to the end product. What they look at is having a right to an equal means of production.
Yes.
And it seems to me like that is what we have to come to, that our, I think that our economy mm-hmm. is really in a death spiral.
I do, we are.
And that's something that we're going to have to learn from and learn really quickly.
I agree with that. I don't know that if it's in a death spiral, but it is not serving very well.
No, not at all.
It does serve, I'm going to
the
say there are parts of the economy that do serve international trade
mm-hmm.
And other sort of macroeconomic functions that our money system was actually designed to work toward. And I don't know that that's instantly replaceable. But I think our question around the whole issue of ownership
mm-hmm.
And who has the Well, it's the means of production. I mean, I very much appreciate the language you put around it because I think it's absolutely right. And it becomes then a question of community self-determination, because you want the community to determine who's the best person to use this resource for mm-hmm. the benefit of the whole.
Yes.
I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. And I think that is where yeah. that local currency comes yeah. into place, because from the research that I've done, the U.S. currency is actually backed by the Rothschilds, that the Federal Reserve is on loan to us and gets repaid with interest.
With interest. As soon as it comes off the press, it's got interest on
it. Which means that if that interest then if we continue to have to pay interest on the money that was used to go back and pay interest, then inflation and the watering down of that currency is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the fact, so it always is going to lose value. You really can never just save. You have to try to keep up with inflation by giving your money back to the wealthiest, you know, portions,
right.
so that you can then try to make interest on it, no matter what kind of damage it's doing in the world.
Yeah. So, and Ellen Brown, who wrote a book called The Web of Debt.
The Web of Debt.
Yeah. It's called The Web of Debt, has articulated that in just extraordinary clarity with all the data and all of the rest. And just to add complexity to the fire, that interest is compounded rather than simple interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even a linear curve. It's actually, it rises extraordinarily quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a problem.
A crime.
And I guess the community self-determination is that communities also have the capacity to issue their own currencies.
The alternative currencies.
Except that those currencies are then taxed. You know, if those currencies are, yes, they have to be. You know, it's only legal to create an alternative currency if it continues to be taxed.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's actually then more traceable. If I pay someone in cash, I mean, cash is actually a beautiful form of local
mm-hmm.
currency because it's not traceable.
Mm-hmm.
There is a form of alternative currency that we're looking at trying to create, which I call a Fair Trade 10. So that for every $50 that goes to a global charity, we replace it with a Fair Trade 10, which is designed by the students and hand-colored by them and signed. And then that becomes a thank you. It's not actually a currency. You call it a thank you. It's a thank you for the charitable gift. And then my person at the farmer's market then thanks that person who gave the money to the charity. And then somebody else thanks the person the farmer. So it can continue to circulate, but not as a currency, but as mm-hmm. a kind of a movable thank you.
Well, I would say that's a currency.
Yeah, but we can't call it that.
No.
The IRS might be listening.
But
well,
it works within the community.
I mean, there are I mean, we actually, if you sit down and begin to tease out if you think through your whole day and all of the exchanges,
mm-hmm.
language has a quality of currency, right? That's how ideas travel. Reputation is a kind of currency. We depend on reputation. I mean, if I hadn't written a book and created some reputation, I probably wouldn't be on this show with you, right?
Probably.
So, and hopefully if people are listening and they feel, well, there's some credibility there, then I'm building reputational currency, which then is, I call it a buy currency, because that then allows me, in mm-hmm. a sense, to, if somebody has a need, to serve that need. And we already have built trust because mm-hmm. trust is based on reputation.
Yes.
At the beginning of the show, though, you said that all money was not the same. But I think actually money is. I mean, that's the problem with it, is that it's anonymous. A dollar that's made by a farmer spends exactly the same as a dollar that's made by a mercenary soldier. If we could create a currency which only came into being by giving this gift of $50, of five times its value, to someone half a world away, then we would have made that money holy.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I think it takes on a whole different value of being life-enhancing without ever being able to be used in the same way.
Right.
There's a spirit to it and a different intention, a different energy behind it. Is that what
It is more in the gift economy.
Yes.
Mode, and I think that that's a really, I think it's a very important piece. And I would go back to Nipun, who Mehta, who is, you know, charity focused.
Yes.
And he made a very interesting point. And he said they tried a little experiment around a toll booth, and in one line in the toll booth, they went ahead and they paid the toll for the person behind them. And in the other line, they didn't do that. So at the end of the day, think about how the people felt who went through the line where they had been paid for and they were paying the next person after them. And the other line where, you know, everybody had to dig in their pocket or, you know, pull out their transponder or whatever that is and pay their toll, the bridge toll collectors ended up with the same amount of money. So it wasn't an issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
But think about the experience. And so it isn't about the dollars. It's about the structure. Right,
mm-hmm.
And the inner intentional gesture that comes with it—it's totally different. Mm-hmm. I tell you what—I much rather get in the line where the person's paying, you know, for me in front.
Nipun is wonderful, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
For listeners who don't know, Nipun Mehta has started something called CharityFocus.org. And it has gathered hundreds of, maybe even thousands at this point, of people who look at how they can give without expecting anything in return. They run the Karma Kitchen up in, I think it's in Oakland or Berkeley?
It's in Berkeley.
In Berkeley, yeah, yeah. And just they send out four different emails that all have different accounts of just beautiful things that people are doing. It's very life-affirming.
Yes.
You know, we only have five more minutes, unfortunately.
Wow.
I know this hour just flew, and before we have to wrap it up, how do you see spirit in money, if you can just go into that a little bit?
Well, I think you touched on it a little bit earlier around the quality of intention.
Yes.
So it has to do... Well, I guess I'm going to use a quick example because it's a topic we could spend actually the whole day exploring.
I'm going to have you back on again.
Well, okay. I would say, you know, my son came and asked me for some money, and he's 18, so you can tell how well I've trained him. And I said, sure, no problem. And he said, are there any strings attached to this? Right? I mean... Smart question, right?
Yes.
And I said, actually, and I caught myself, you know, how sometimes you just make a response and you don't know exactly where it came from. And what I said to him is, well, actually, there are no strings attached. It is the string itself. And what I meant by that is that I was handing it to him, and we were connected not necessarily through the dollars, but through the transaction.
Mm.
And it was had a quality of gift, but... If you follow my good intentions to support him, he goes out and does something in the world. Those intentions are a whole currency moving around the world. We don't usually tap into that to get our energy in a way. And not actually all of the intentions that are circulating are positive.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so developing a capacity to discern where there are positive intentions and negative intentions, I know, for example, that donors... Experienced donors know when a request is coming that is a sincere request versus one that may be more in the manipulative, because they've had to train their instinct, for lack of a better word, intuition, their sense of the truth of intention. And people are smart. People are way smarter than most people give credit for.
Mm-hmm.
They know when something isn't right. And much of our educational structures are designed to get people not to trust that, even though
True.
They have that natural wisdom, right? So when it comes to money, I think we are really separated from those natural, I would say, I'm going to call them instincts. They're not quite instincts, but sense of rightness in a way, or appropriateness, or safety, or truth, or trust. So that's the part that has to be
There's
cultivated.
A disconnect that was there at one point.
Exactly. And to me, that is what I would call the spiritual part that is also connected with money. Well, one picture that Rudolf Steiner gives is if you look at the spectrum of light and you look at the rainbow, which is, of course, a very beautiful experience, light, we know, continues into the infrared, into the ultraviolet on both sides of the visible spectrum. And it is a continuity, but it has energy. We know infrared and ultraviolet are very powerful forces, even though we can't see them.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the intentional part of the money is in that infrared ultraviolet part. Can't see it necessarily, but it is there, and it has an energetic effect that it travels with the money. So the money actually is a string of energy.
And you really touched upon it in more detail in the chapter on faith, hope, and love, elements of an appreciative economy, past, present, and future, associated with each quality. Oh, I wish we had more time. And then how that can be transformative, one person at a time, one reflection at a time.
Well, that's a hope. And
that's a hope. That's future.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh,
and you know,
I
think this transformation is a process, and you know, we can only start from where we are. And if we live in, you know, judging everything that's wrong, we get kind of stuck there.
That's true.
I think we have to be mindful that there are very powerful shadow forces at work in it, but not be ruled by it.
I love the painting of Judas with the shadow figure behind him when he's being paid off, too.
Yeah.
And the
or
energy
bribed,
of that.
Actually.
Oh, and your critique of art and money. It was amazing. I thoroughly enjoyed your critiques and how applicable they are today. Well, is there anything you want to say as we close?
Well, I just want to first appreciate the questions and I would say the rightness of tapping into passion, even if it doesn't necessarily mean anybody agrees about it. One of the beauties of money is it is a great source of conflict. We know that it's a very powerful source of conflict, and therefore it's a great source of potential transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And not to be afraid of that. I guess that's my, you know, my take on it.
Well, thank you.
It's been a great pleasure, John.
It
Likewise,
certainly
and I,
has.
I want to find out, hear about more about your front yard garden.
She has her own show,
right?
Third Paradigm.
If you go to thirdparadigm.org, there's a link on the menu that says Food in the Hood. And we have a brand new page with pictures and photos and videos, and it's really fun.
We were one of the, I think probably the first supporters of the People's Grocery. In Oakland, and I'm sure you're aware of that. Again,
of course,
this is how to be in touch with a project over long term. So that is highly transformative.
Very nice.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
One
so I think you're on a very similar kind of path, and it comes with some challenges and a system that isn't necessarily going to support it.
Yeah, that's quite a precedent to live up to.
That's true, but she'll do it. If anyone will, she will.
Well, you know, the fact is that you will do it, but the community needs it to happen as well.
Yeah.
So you're actually enabling the community to transform itself.
Yeah.
And that's really been the fun part of it, is that I've gotten to know neighbors that I've lived next to now for 25 years and haven't met before. But now we have Grow Food Party Crews, and we go and we, you know, help different people put in food gardens, and it's been really fun.
Oh, we've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Well, thank you again, and I hope that there are other shows addressing aspects of money as well, because it's a hugely unexplored topic.
It is, but you've started it.
Well,
and it's so all-encompassing, too, and in depth. The genius of money, the genius of, this is a new Bible for our future source of revenue.
Yeah, just to be clear,
it's
I'm not
exciting.
The genius of money. I'm talking about the money actually has a kind of genius to it.
And I think you're a genius, too. But on that note, Palestinian news is waiting for us, and I'll get a call from Dennis soon if I don't get it on.
Okay. Well, thank you both
so much. Thank you so much.
Bye, John. And I look forward to meeting in person, both of you,
I
at some point
so.
Or another.
That would be great.
I certainly do, and Anne-Marie will be here, too.
Great.
All right.
All right. Take care.
You, too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 14th, 2010. Israeli troops demolished three houses in the West Bank and opened fire at a nonviolent protest in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli military demolished three houses in the West Bank on Wednesday in Al-Khadr and Beit Sahur near Bethlehem and the village of Haris near Salfit. In Bethlehem, Israeli bulldozers demolished the house that belongs to Omar Ribhi from the town of Beit Sahur. The owner told IMEMC that he was planning to build a warehouse with an area of 1,000 square meters. Ribhi said that he put the construction on hold